The Justice Department agrees to turn over key evidence from the Robert Mueller Russia investigation to Congress. It's Monday, June 10th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good afternoon, I'm Jack Lepiarz. Coming up, the decision by DOJ comes after weeks of tense negotiations. Members of the House Judiciary Committee say it could reveal more about possible obstruction of justice by the president. Also, the Red Sox say David Ortiz could be flown to Boston tonight for more medical treatment after being shot in the Dominican yesterday.
David Ortiz is probably the most beloved and one of the most important players in our history.
And controversy over coyote population control in Wyoming. It's 4:01. First, this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Federal investigators are on their way to Midtown Manhattan, where a privately owned helicopter crash landed on the roof of a skyscraper this afternoon. The pilot was killed. A short time ago, officials said there was no indication this was terror-related. Governor Andrew Cuomo was on the scene shortly after the helicopter crashed, evoking memories for many of 9/11.
I remember that morning all too well. So as soon as you hear an aircraft hit a building, I think my mind goes where every New Yorker's mind goes.
Dozens of emergency personnel will remain on the scene, and traffic around the Manhattan building is halted. A contempt vote targeting Attorney General William Barr is still on, even though the Justice Department has started to send over materials in compliance with the House Judiciary Committee subpoena. Lawmakers have been demanding evidence used in former special counsel Robert Mueller's report on his probe into the Russian election breach and alleged obstruction by the Trump White House. NPR Susan Davis reports all committee members will be able to view the materials.
House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler said in a statement that the Justice Department has agreed to begin complying with the panel's existing subpoena for information that was not made public in the Mueller report on Russia's election interference. Nadler did not identify the information, but said it was in regards to evidence the special counsel used to assess whether or not President Trump obstructed justice. The Mueller report did not draw a conclusion on obstruction, but made a point to say it did not exonerate the president either. The agreement will not affect a scheduled Tuesday vote in the House to authorize the committee to fight Barr in civil court to turn over that evidence, though Nadler says if DOJ complies, he won't need to take that action. Susan Davis, NPR News, The Capitol.
The U.S. Supreme Court is refusing to hear an appeal from a Yemeni man held without charge at Guantanamo for more than 17 years. But in a statement today, Justice Stephen Breyer writes, it is past time to examine the indefinite detention of prisoners at Gitmo. And Pierre's Nina Totenberg reports of the 40 remaining there, only 10 have been convicted of or charged with war crimes.
Mawaz Al-Alwi is among those never charged. Although the justices declined to hear his case, Justice Breyer laid down something of a marker. In 2004, he said, the court understood that when Congress passed the authorization for use of military force after 9/11, it permitted the president to detain certain enemy combatants until the end of the relevant conflict. But the court cautioned it was not authorizing, quote, perpetual detention. And Al-Alwi now faces, quote, the very real prospect that he will spend the rest of his life in detention based on his status as an enemy combatant a generation ago. It is past time, Breyer wrote, to confront the difficult questions left open by such lengthy detentions without charge. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Before the close, the Dow is up 78 points. This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. Red Sox great David Ortiz is expected to be transported from the Dominican Republic to Boston for continuing medical care. Last night, Ortiz was shot in the back at a bar in the Dominican Republic. Sox team president Sam Kennedy says the air transport is expected sometime later today or tonight.
Our medical team here in Boston and the doctors in the Dominican Republic have confirmed that David's condition is still serious, but that he is stable enough to be transported back here to Boston.
An Ortiz spokesman says doctors have removed his gallbladder and part of his intestines. Police have called the shooting an ambush and are trying to determine if Ortiz was the gunman's intended target. Meantime, Massachusetts is home to more than 140,000 Dominicans, many of whom say they're in shock at the news. WBUR's Simone Rios reports.
Most people know Ortiz as Big Papi, the smiling slugger who helped bring Boston glory on the baseball field. But for Jose de la Rosa, Ortiz's barber since 2004, Big Papi is known just as David. I've been going to his house and cutting his hair for 10 years, De La Rosa says, and I can tell you he's lovable, friendly, and feels the pain of others. Now Ortiz is expected to return to Boston, where medical professionals can give back to a man who's given so much to the city. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Simon Rios.
Shares in Waltham-based Raytheon were up nearly 1% today on news that it plans to merge with Connecticut-based United Technologies. The deal would create a massive aerospace and defense company based in the Boston area. And the companies say they expect the combination to create jobs, but leaders with unions at both companies say they're concerned about what the deal means for workers. In the forecast, mostly cloudy tonight with rain and possible thunderstorms moving in just after the evening commute, temperatures in the 60s. Rain for tomorrow morning, then clouds in the afternoon. Still a lot of humidity, highs in the upper 70s. Right now, 78 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Museum of Science. Tickets on sale now for Body Worlds and the Cycle of Life. Get the inside story on your body at this life-changing exhibition, MOS.org. And the law firm Cooley LLP, with offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Audie Cornish. We start this hour at an immigration checkpoint in southern Mexico. Late last week, the U.S. and Mexico struck a deal on immigration, a deal that stopped President Trump from carrying out a threat to impose tariffs.
As part of that deal, Mexico pledged to deploy its brand new National Guard to fight illegal immigration. Mexico also said it would keep more Central American migrants on its side of the border while the U.S. processes their asylum claims. In a few moments, we'll hear about the strain this puts on Mexican cities.
First, we're joined by reporter James Frederick at that checkpoint in southern Mexico. And James, I understand you're about 30 minutes from the border with Guatemala. Can you talk about what you've been seeing there?
Yeah, so I'm under a bridge on a highway that goes north from the Guatemala-Mexico border. And there's about 10 immigration agents here, as well as federal police and soldiers. And this is really what they're doing for migration enforcement right now. This is looking to change with the agreement that was made between U.S. and Mexico recently. Mexican officials say that 6,000 National Guards members will be coming down here. And the National Guard is really the main new security force by President Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
Tell us more about the Mexican National Guard, because it was just announced a few weeks ago. What's going on there?
So the National Guard is really the primary security policy of President López Obrador, who is in his first year here. And basically, he pitched the National Guard as a modern, sophisticated, kind of hybrid military-civilian force. This force would basically have police powers to arrest people. And then specifically talking about migration, it would be the only security force in Mexico that would have the authority on its own to arrest undocumented migrants. This is really all theoretical right now because President López Obrador has talked a lot about it, but there is no active National Guard right now. And we're kind of waiting to see exactly when National Guard gets rolled out.
My next question was going to be whether these Guard members have been trained, but you're saying this force doesn't exist yet. So where are they going to come from?
Well, so what we know so far is about 1,500 National Guards members are currently being trained. They're not fully trained yet. And this training question is really important because, as President López Obrador has pushed it, this is a modern force. It's going to be very respectful of human rights. He said Mexican police and army have had several scandals around human rights. And the feeling that they are trying to rush this out for migration enforcement really doesn't engender a lot of confidence that this is going to be the modern security force that can make Mexico safer.
You've underscored that troublesome history. Can you talk about how people are reacting to this? Is it controversial in Mexico?
Yeah, it's really just a sense of not knowing what the National Guard is right now. I spoke earlier today to the mayor of the town of Ciudad Hidalgo. It's the little town that's right on the Mexico-Guatemala border. She said she has no news about when National Guard might be on the border, but she did say the federal government got in touch with her to ask her to find a plot of land where they could build a National Guard base. So, I mean, that also gives you an idea of what stage the National Guard is really at in being rolled out.
In the end, is this establishment of the National Guard and this cooperation with the U.S. going to be a major kind of policy issue for López Obrador? Like, is this going to be part of his political legacy?
It sure seems like it, because, you know, the National Guard is what he said was going to be the thing that solves violence in Mexico. And what I'm really curious to see is if they indeed roll out these first, you know, 6,000 National Guard members here to the border, how are Mexicans going to react? This is a force they thought was going to be used to fight organized crime here in Mexico. If it's just for migration enforcement, I don't expect that Mexicans are going to feel very happy about that.
That's reporter James Frederick in southern Mexico. Thank you for your reporting.
Thanks, Adi.
Let's head now to Mexico's northern border and look at another aspect of this U.S.-Mexico deal. The city of Tijuana is like a lot of Mexican cities in that it is struggling to house and care for Central American migrants forced to stay in Mexico as their asylum claims in the U.S. are being processed. That program that keeps migrants in Mexico is now set to expand as part of this new agreement. NPR's Carrie Kahn was just in Tijuana. She joined us now from the other side of the border in San Diego. Hey, Carrie.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi. So the so-called Remain in Mexico program, which we've been talking about for a while, I said it's going to change. How so?
The U.S. government wants to send more U.S. asylum seekers back to Mexico to wait out their court procedures. And it began in December, but the U.S. government wants to send a lot more people back. And so that's the expansion that we're talking about.
So we're talking same program, more numbers.
Mexico's foreign minister was directly asked, how can you take in more numbers? What are we talking about, 20, 30,000? He sort of avoided the question and said, our southern border enforcement and our buildup of troops along the southern border with Guatemala is really going to help stem the numbers that are coming to the border. So this might be a moot point in general. We might not have to take back as many people. But that's a big grasp, and we'll have to see how quickly they can bring the troops down to the border and whether they can make a difference.
I mentioned you've just been in Tijuana, Carrie. I mean, what is the impact there of this policy?
There have always been migrants in Tijuana. This has always been a throughway and a big crossing point for migrants. So this is nothing new for the city. The number of people that are staying now and not just going through, that is new. But if you look at the Remain in Mexico program, since December, Mexico has sent back about almost 11,000 U.S. asylum-seeking migrants. Not all of those have gone to Tijuana. And Tijuana is a city of about 1.5 million people. So it's not that huge of an impact. The problem is that they all stay congregated along the border region, which is not a very safe part of town. And there are no resources from the federal government there to help them out. So nonprofits and church groups and religious organizations are the ones that are picking up the slack. And it's been a difficult situation for those groups and that area around the border.
I wonder, is this sparking tension between cities and their leaders, mayors and so forth, and the federal government in Mexico City?
Definitely. They've been asking for more resources since we've seen these large migrant caravans come up to the border, and they've been demanding more resources, and it has created tensions between the states and the federal government.
What about for the migrants themselves? What have you been able to observe through your reporting in terms of the impact on them of staying longer in Mexico under this program?
It's a difficult situation because they don't have relatives here. They don't have a support system here. The government has not been able to provide jobs and stable areas to stay in. And what's happening is that this is not where they want to stay. They want to go to the United States. They don't feel safe in Tijuana. They don't feel safe in border cities along Mexico. And their ultimate goal is to make it to the U.S.
NPR's Carrie Kahn. Thanks, Carrie.
You're welcome.
Bushwick Bill of the Houston rap group Ghetto Boys has died at age 52.
This year, Halloween fell on a weekend. Me and Ghetto Boys are trick-or-treating, robbing little kids for bags.
Bushwick Bill was born Richard Shaw in Kingston, Jamaica. His family moved to the Bushwick section of Brooklyn when he was a kid, but Houston, Texas is where he became a Ghetto Boy, joining Willie D and Scarface to become pioneers of gangster rap. He told his fans that he had pancreatic cancer just last month. Now, to talk about Bushwick Bill and his legacy is NPR's Rodney Carmichael. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Audie.
Tell us about Bushwick Bill as a rapper.
Well, Bushwick Bill, he was a vivid storyteller and really one of the most charismatic figures in hip-hop. He ended up getting into rap almost by accident, and really now he deserves probably more credit than just about anybody for popularizing Southern rap, and especially horrorcore.
Horrorcore. Okay, tell me a little bit about that, because that came around, what, the late 80s?
Yeah, so horrorcore was basically like this offshoot of gangster rap, you know, these really graphic descriptions of murder and mutilation, often of women. But Bushwick was also a guy who'd actually been studying to become a missionary and a minister before all of this. Then there's the fact that he was a little person with a disability that really made him an outcast and made his own life pretty horrific in some ways.
Hardship is kind of hard to swallow. See, it's rough being a loner. Not knowing any given day and time, I could wind up a goner. Some people got it back.
Violence and trauma was a world that Bushwick was not, you know, afraid to deal with, and it wasn't always fictional. You know, one of the heaviest songs on his debut album, Little Big Man, it basically lays out a real life event where Bushwick lost his eye to a gunshot during an argument with his girlfriend. And he even ends up being declared dead before coming back to life when this happens. And he was drunk on Everclear at the time, he says in the song, and that inspired the song's title, which was Ever So Clear, which really ends up being this clear-eyed, really confessional song of enlightenment for Bushwick.
See, most of my life, I never had this. I felt like an outcast, treated like a misfit. Damn near didn't make it on my day of birth. Thinking, was I really supposed to be on this planet Earth? I take a deep breath and then another follows. Because hardship is kind of hard to swallow. See, it's rough.
I know it's a long way from his early days of studying religion, but toward the end of his life and career, what kind of music was he doing?
Well, you know, Bushwick made the classic 360-degree circle in his life and time, and he really ended up returning back to his roots and to Christianity. He got born again, and he was really making music that was a lot closer to gospel in his later years. Very uplifting music.
Till the rapture comes, I'm back to song. I thought I told y'all I was gonna bump like this. I ain't gotta be drunk off Chris. I'm drunk off the spirit of God, ripping it raw.
And, you know, but it wasn't the type of thing where he totally disowned what he had done in the past. He had unique ways of being able to mesh together all of the routes his life had taken into one big story that he felt like was a made him a witness and an inspiration for a lot of people.
That's NPR's Rodney Carmichael talking to us about the legacy of Bushwick Bill of the Ghetto Boys. Bill died at the age of
52. A nice fella, not a gorilla from out the jungle. Got money by the bundle, but I ain't flashy. Smooth like the lotion, so I ain't ashy. I'm following the footsteps of Jesus.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by DCU, Digital Federal Credit Union, where you can refinance your car loan and reduce your monthly payments. What can DCU save you? DCU.org. And Cityside Subaru in Belmont, where the Love Spring event is underway. CitysideSubaru.com, the beauty of all-wheel drive, the beauty of springtime.
Coming up on WBUR's All Things Considered, an Alabama Department of Corrections inmate offers his take on why the state's prisons are so unsafe. In business news, an Arizona-based drug company is declaring bankruptcy 1 month after its founder was convicted of racketeering in Boston federal court. The move by Insys Therapeutics also comes just days after one of its operating units agreed to a $225 million settlement with federal regulators over allegations of bribing doctors to prescribe a fentanyl spray to patients. On Wall Street, a positive day for the markets. Dow rose 78 points, 26,062. NASDAQ was up 81 points, and the S&P 500 up 13 points. Remember, coming up at WBUR City Space on Friday, June 14th, TV writer and YouTube star Zach Sherwin hosts the Crossword Show with three local comedians trying to solve a crossword live on stage. Details at WBUR.org/cityspace. Forecast says showers and storms tonight. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
The clouds will continue to thicken up the rest of the afternoon. Temperatures stay in the mid-70s. Then tonight we'll watch an area of showers over southwestern New England overspread the rest of us. We're in the mid-60s. It's quite muggy. Some of those showers could be accompanied by thunder and some downpours. Tomorrow, We're in the mid-70s to perhaps even near 80 as the showers come to an end. Wednesday, sunshine, drier in the mid-70s. Thursday, showers are back, upper 60s to near 70, but it's sunshine again for the end of the week. Friday, mostly sunny, low 70s.
Right now, 79 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from the Alzheimer's Association, working toward a vision of a world without Alzheimer's, providing care and support to all those facing the disease with a commitment to advancing critical research. More at alz.org. And Fidelity Investments, taking a personalized approach to helping clients grow, preserve, and manage their wealth. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Nowadays, your listener feedback usually comes in the form of a tweet or an email or a message on Facebook. But every once in a while, we still get a real posted letter.
This story is about one of those letters. Printed neatly, in all caps, it begins, Audie Cornish. I am an inmate in the Alabama Department of Corrections and an avid listener of NPR News. So we got the writer on the phone. Collect call from prison. Hello, is this David Crenshaw?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Mr. Crenshaw. My name is Audie Cornish. I was the one who did the interview that you heard.
Hey, great to meet you.
Yes, great to almost meet you as well.
Yeah, I've been listening to yours for a while now.
I didn't know you could listen to the show. So tell me, like, how you guys heard this.
Oh, you know, we had an NPR station here in Alabama down toward the end of the dial. I think it's like 91, 92. We listen to it all the time.
David Crenshaw has served 26 years of a 28-year sentence for attempted murder and a number of other lesser crimes. He wrote to us after hearing an interview I did with Alabama State Senator Cam Ward about the state's prison system.
People in some of these state prisons, you treat animals at your house better than that. It is a blemish in our state.
Alabama's prisons have the highest rate of inmate homicides in the country, nearly two dozen between the years of 2015 and 2017 alone. That's according to a Department of Justice report. That same report found violence had increased dramatically in recent years. It said prisons are so dangerous, there is, quote, reasonable cause to believe they violate inmates' constitutional rights.
Many are built on a warehouse mentality where you put 400 or 500 people in one big warehouse. You can't have enough officers with that kind of layout and not expect there to be some problems.
Senator Ward and I talked about what it would take to curb that violence, plans to build more prisons, the need to fix locks and install cameras, hire more officers and pay them more. David Crenshaw, the letter writer, says the interview with Senator Ward got inmates talking because the issues Ward cited, the overcrowding, neglected buildings, Crenshaw says they were problems long before the epidemic of violence.
You know, basically the general reaction was, you know, how is that contributing to the increase in violence when, you know, our living conditions have been terrible for so many years, and throughout those years, we never just felt like our life being in danger the way it is today, you know.
Today, Crenshaw says, everyone feels unsafe.
Basically, everybody incarcerated feels in danger.
Overcrowding and understaffing, every system across the nation deals with that.
Charlotte Morrison is an attorney with the Equal Justice Initiative. The group has investigated allegations of abuse in Alabama's prisons for decades. It even sued the Department of Corrections.
We get letters, calls, emails every single day, 10 to 20 of them.
We asked Morrison to listen to some of our conversation with David Crenshaw and the factors that he thinks are responsible for the surge in violence. For example, the staffing issue. Crenshaw says a bigger problem is the way officers today are trained.
These officers coming in, they're not being trained, they're just thrown on the job. And many of them, being as young as they are, they're basically coming in the same mentality as a lot of the inmates. And, you know, I just look at it like they're just another gang in prison, you know, because a lot of the times that they deal with situations, they deal with it violently anyway, you know.
So you got an inmate saying it feels like some of the officers end up behaving like they're in just another gang, that they have the same mentality as the inmates, a criminal mentality. Is that surprising to you?
No, I think that punitive doesn't go far enough. I think that there is a violent culture of prison management. We've talked to a dozen officers about their experience in the prisons, and they all say that they had modeling as cadets by other officers, this use of force style of management. rather than the rehabilitative management, and that that was, you know, quite frankly, frightening for these officers who reported, you know, that they're not violent people. They are not going to hit somebody unless they are hit, but that the expectation is that you will embrace a use of force that is not necessary given the lack of a threat in the immediate environment.
I want to come to another idea from this inmate.
Once, you know, years back, we had quite a few different outlets to deal with our incarceration and, you know, work on rehabilitating ourselves so that we can return to society.
He mentions work detail, road and field work.
There were other programs, like self-help programs that was sponsored by the state. A lot of those programs have been done away with. You know, these guys being thrown up in here, they have basically nothing to do, just sitting around with idle time on their hands. And, of course, you know, the depression set in, and when the depression set in, and it always come out with a violent outcome, seems like.
What can you tell us about what kind of activities are left for Alabama inmates?
Well, at the prison that we sued, when we brought our suit in 2014, there were 1,500 people in the prison. Many people enter prison with substance abuse problems. And at St. Clair Prison, there were no drug programs, no AA or NA programs for the majority of people incarcerated there. But they really had no other programming as well. And the majority of prisoners spent their time idle in the dorms. They have no structure to their days. And the lack of staff meant that the department had abandoned most security protocols. They weren't doing bed checks. They weren't controlling movement. They're not doing contraband checks. And this led to a drug epidemic in the prison. And hundreds of prisoners then fall into debt to other prisoners. And that debt is enforced through physical and sexual violence.
What do you think about this moment? You know, for an organization like us to be getting a letter from an inmate, the New York Times, you know, received many photographs of what was going on inside the prisons. Does it speak to the fear?
Absolutely. It speaks to the fear, but it also speaks to the lack of access to the courts or to anyone else who would listen. The fact that people are going to the media, I think, just speaks to the desperation that people have in trying to get their complaints heard and these conditions acknowledged.
That's Charlotte Morrison with the Equal Justice Initiative. The inmate we spoke to, David Crenshaw, left us with a suggestion for legislators or anyone else working to reform Alabama's prisons.
To hear from the inmates, everybody that's talking about this subject, they're looking at things from their own point of view, but when is somebody going to look at it from the point of view of the inmate?
Tomorrow, we'll share that point of view with the commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections, Jeff Dunn.
We recognize that we have staff that are not abiding by our core values, and we are seeking to identify those staff and address those issues very aggressively.
Dunn has just released a new strategic plan to address the violence inside Alabama's prisons. We'll have more about that tomorrow on All Things Considered.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, digging into the merger news involving Connecticut-based United Technologies and Waltham's Raytheon. In the forecast, mostly cloudy tonight with rain and possible thunderstorms moving in just after the evening commute. Temperatures in the 60s. Right now, 78 degrees in Boston at 429.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Brigham Health Orthopedic and Arthritis Center, advancing orthopedic care with robotic surgery, same-day joint replacement, and more. Orthopedics.brighamandwomens.org. And BU School of Social Work Professional Education Programs, take your social work career to the next level. pep.bu.edu.
The Southern Baptist Convention is having a reckoning over sexual abuse.
Can we trust our church leaders to not only not be abusing, but to also be prohibiting people who could be abusers from having a place where they can do it with impunity?
Do women in the church have any power?
I think there's just something about the order of creation that means that God intends for the preaching voice to be a male voice.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR News station.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. On Capitol Hill, the House Judiciary Committee heard the testimony this afternoon by one of the key figures from the Watergate era. NPR's Windsor Johnston tells us former White House counsel John Dean spoke before the panel as it continues to investigate Russian election interference and possible obstruction by President Trump.
Dean, who was a principal witness during the Senate Watergate hearings, told the committee that he sees remarkable parallels between Watergate and the findings of former special counsel Robert Mueller.
In many ways, the Mueller report is to President Trump what the so-called Watergate roadmap was to President Richard Nixon. Stated a little differently, special counsel Mueller has provided this committee with a roadmap.
Notably, Dean called on his Trump-era counterpart, former White House counsel Don McGahn, to testify before the committee. McGahn was seen as a key witness in Mueller's report on whether the president obstructed justice. The White House has ordered McGahn to defy a congressional subpoena. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Iran's foreign minister Javad Zarif says Washington will not win an economic war against his country. Terry Schultz reports the warning came as Germany's foreign minister visited Tehran to calm tensions and keep the nuclear deal intact.
Zarif had an ominous message for Washington, saying the U.S. cannot expect to stay safe if it maintains sanctions, which could bolster arguments Tehran poses an imminent military threat. German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas was there trying to keep alive the nuclear deal the U.S. quit last year. He promised the special financial exchange mechanism Europeans are setting up to trade with Tehran would be operational soon, but it's way behind schedule, and Iran is losing patience.
That's Terry Schultz reporting. Stocks finish higher on Wall Street today. The Dow was up 78 points. The tech-heavy Nasdaq added 81 points. This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. Red Sox star David Ortiz is expected to be flown from the Dominican Republic to Boston and arrive here later this evening for continued medical treatment. It's according to Sox leaders who provided an update this afternoon on last night's shooting of Ortiz at a bar in his home country. As WBUR's Shira Springer explains, police said an interview of the alleged shooter was delayed because of injuries he suffered after the shooting.
Investigators are now in the process in the Dominican of trying to figure out what the motive was. If you watch the video of the shooting, it was, you know, it was done at very close range, some might say point blank range. He was ambushed, shot from behind by a man who jumped off of a motorcycle, shot him, and then tried to get away, but then was sort of captured, I guess is the way you describe it, by a crowd at the bar and beaten.
Red Sox assistant general manager Eddie Romero says security can be difficult for athletes like Ortiz wherever they go because of their exposure, and not just in the Dominican Republic.
There are measures that we try taking and we try to educate our players, but it's not just limited to, you know, David in this instance or baseball. It's a problem that, you know, you encounter in a lot of places with high-profile athletes.
Red Sox management says Ortiz is in serious condition but stable enough to return to Boston. A spokesman for the former designated hitter says doctors removed his gallbladder and parts of his intestines. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh will not hire another education chief in City Hall. WBUR's Max Larkin reports the mayor is eliminating the cabinet-level position, which he created.
When Walsh took office, he created the education chief as a point person overseeing big initiatives like universal pre-kindergarten and a district-wide facilities overhaul. Now the city's on track to have adequate pre-K seats by 2024. And that overhaul, called Build BPS, is well underway. So Walsh says he'll go without an education chief. Instead, he'll lend his support to incoming Superintendent Brenda Caselius and her team.
I think my job is to provide them with the tools they need to be successful. And I also think it's my job to be the biggest supporter of Boston Public Schools in the city.
Caselius will take over at BPS on July 1st. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Max Larkin.
The Massachusetts House has a new officer tasked with investigating allegations of sexual misconduct. Comes 1 year after the Equal Employment Opportunity Officer position was created as part of several new procedures addressing misconduct. Employment attorney John McLafferty will hold the position for 2 years. People in Greater Boston are more likely to work past the retirement age than in other parts of the country. It's according to census data that show counties around Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Washington make up a large portion of counties where more than 20% of seniors are working or looking for work. In the forecast, it'll be mostly cloudy tonight with rain and possible thunderstorms moving in just after the evening commute. Temperatures in the 60s. Right now it's 78 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Focus Features with The Dead Don't Die, a comedy from director Jim Jarmusch about one town's fight against the zombie apocalypse, starring Bill Murray, Adam Driver, Tilda Swinton, and Chloe Sevigny, in theaters Friday. And Uma, a cloud-based phone service for small businesses with features to automatically route and provide custom messages to callers. Uma, the smartphone for your business. More at OOMA.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Two very large aerospace and defense firms want to become one massive one. Raytheon and United Technologies say they have agreed to merge. This is raising questions about a possible reduction in competition among military contractors. Here's President Trump speaking on CNBC today.
When I hear they're merging, does that take away more competition? It becomes one big, fat, beautiful company. But I have to negotiate, meaning the United States has to buy things.
Well, let's bring in NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie. He is in the studio. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Mary Louise.
What about the president's concerns there that this is going to be one big fat company and might pose a challenge for competition in the industry?
Well, this would create the second biggest company in this space, trailing only Boeing. And the industry players have been shrinking for decades. There's a sort of long-running consolidation and down to a handful of large companies. So certainly a legitimate concern. But when I called Todd Harrison, who very closely tracks military spending at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, he didn't really see it as a big problem.
I don't think that they have a lot of overlap where they have duplicative capabilities. And so it's not really a matter of narrowing the number of companies that could compete for defense contracts in the future.
All right, Greg Myrie, let's tease that out a little bit. He says there's not a lot of overlap. These companies are doing different things, are they?
Yeah, they are. Raytheon, which dates back almost a century, it's based in Waltham, Massachusetts, done a lot of non-military things over the years. It invented the microwave oven, for example. But today, think missiles, Tomahawk missiles, the Patriot missile defense system, radar, electronic warfare systems. About 90% or so of its operations are related to military and defense. United Technologies, based in Connecticut, real innovator with GPS systems, for example. Today, maybe jet engines is the thing they're most identified with. Both military aircraft, things like the cutting-edge F-35 fighter jets, but also civilian aircraft, Airbus planes, for example. But only about 25% of their business is defense-related.
This merger looking like a done deal?
Likely at this point. Shareholders and regulators would still have to approve this, and the new company would be called Raytheon Technologies and based near Boston. Both these companies have very healthy profits. Their stock prices are up. It wasn't some sort of urgent deal that one of them needed to do. They just say it's something that's good for business, will allow them to work on their, both of them work on their specialties.
And what might this deal tell us, Greg, about overall defense spending, where the Pentagon's overall budget may be heading? Any clues in there?
Yeah, we don't know for sure. And obviously defense spending has been pretty pretty dramatically under President Trump,
yeah.
Over $700 billion a year, aiming for $750 billion this coming year. But lots of uncertainty, the huge budget deficits, you have Democrats in the control of the House, a presidential election next year. So a lot of analysts say they're not expecting big hikes in the defense budget, look for something more in the line of the rate of inflation, and therefore companies may need to prepare for a new atmosphere.
NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie on the case. Thank you, Greg.
My pleasure.
American Airlines now says it's keeping its Boeing 737 MAX jets parked until after the summer travel season. The MAX has been grounded for 3 months. Airlines have asked regulators around the globe to hold a unified press conference when they're confident the planes are safe to fly. That may not restore the confidence of passengers. NPR asked our listeners and online readers, if and when the Federal Aviation Authority allows the 737 MAX back in the air, will you fly it? As NPR's Wade Goodwin reports, the replies came in so fast we had to close the poll after just 24 hours.
Out of the 1,600 people who responded to our questionnaire with their name, email address, and phone number, more than 1,000 said in a variety of iterations, no, I won't fly on the 737 MAX, even if the FAA says it's good to go.
I'm a nervous flyer in general. And so just hearing something like that, it was something that I followed and paid a lot of attention to.
Take Mara Bradshaw, for example. She's an administrative associate at Montana Technological University in Butte.
I feel like there's a lot of faith involved in flying, and any sort of chip in that, it kind of takes away your belief that that system is working safely.
Bradshaw is disillusioned with Boeing's management, but she's particularly upset at the FAA for failing to protect passengers.
We have these institutions that are supposed to ensure our safety, and they're serving a massive company like Boeing, and they kind of let us down in that process. It just felt very wrong to me that they waited so long to ground them.
Jean Pelletier, the chief operating officer for Indigo Pets, says she was stunned to learn that Boeing deliberately removed information about the MAX's new flight control software from the plane's manual. She feels that keeping the pilots in the dark is unforgivable. She flies about 24 times a year, and Pelletier says she's going to avoid the 737 MAX going forward.
Absolutely, positively. And I am not someone who typically looks to see what kind of plane she's on. The most I might check is to see if it has Wi-Fi. But I'm going to France, and I know it's not flying yet, but I'm going to be watching to make sure that if it is released before my flight date, that I'm not on that plane.
Before the MAX came along, Boeing had a reputation for building planes that were pilot-reliant. U.S. pilots even had a joke about it. If it ain't Boeing, I ain't going, throwing shade at Airbus's emphasis on computerized flight controls. With nearly 350 people and 4 colleagues dead, pilots aren't joking about Boeing software anymore. But while most of the respondents to NPR's poll said they wouldn't fly the MAX, hundreds of passengers said they would.
I wouldn't hesitate to do so.
Dr. James McKeith is the medical director for the United States Antarctic Program and a very frequent flyer. McKeith says Boeing has too much at stake not to get it right the second time.
To a certain extent, I think it was safe to begin with. I mean, the 737 is one of the safest aircraft we have. And frankly, you know, in my day-to-day life, one of the safest things I do is get on a commercial aircraft.
Daniel Mill Tyson in Tucson, Arizona, is currently working on getting his flight instructor certification. His faith remains unshaken. He believes Boeing and the FAA will learn from this tragedy, and he'll happily fly on the 737 MAX.
Because Boeing makes generally safe airplanes, and the FAA runs the safest airspace system in the world.
Remember Mara Bradshaw, the anxious flyer in Montana? Although she refuses to consider flying on the MAX now, when asked if that might change down the road, she says this.
I think yes. If a year goes by and the pilots are good with it, they don't see any new problems cropping up, then I think that I would feel safe.
Boeing and the airlines undoubtedly hope there will be a lot more passengers like Bradshaw who might be willing to give the 737 MAX a chance after they wait and see. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. You say coyotes, I say coyotes. We can argue over how you pronounce the word, but what is not in doubt is the federal government is trying to stop them from preying on livestock. In fact, the government is killing thousands of them every year. Critics of that approach have challenged it in court and won. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
In a rugged canyon in southern Wyoming, a helicopter drops nets over a pair of coyotes. They're bound and blindfolded and flown to a landing station. There, University of Wyoming researchers place them on a mat.
It's okay.
104.3, okay.
The animals stay calm and still while people figure out their weight, age, sex.
Hey, can I get just a little bit of water on him, please?
Katie, what are we calling this place?
Grad student Katie Hugler is fitting these coyotes with tracking collars.
What's most important to us is that GPS data.
And what that data has been showing is, boy, did these coyotes roam. Hugler is amazed at one young female that's wandered long distances.
It's like 110 miles as the crow flies. Turned around and came back like 3 days later. And they're moving fast, but they're also moving really far.
But Hugler says all that roaming changes during the short window when mule deer fawns are born. Mule deer populations around the West are way down, and some people blame coyotes. One solution is to kill the coyotes. But UW Wildlife Professor Kevin Monteith points out, if you wipe out a pack of coyotes,
and the next day you just have an exchange of animals that come right back in and fill that place.
In fact, some studies show that if you kill off a lot of coyotes, they breed even more.
Oftentimes, coyote control programs have been implemented. In some or many instances, it seems like the effects were negligible.
Yet these conclusions haven't affected the high number of coyotes killed by wildlife services run by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In 2018, the agency killed over 68,000 coyotes in the U.S. But some wildlife advocacy groups question that approach when the science doesn't necessarily show it works.
This is something that we've been working on at a national scale, really trying to transform wildlife services.
Colette Adkins is with the Center for Biological Diversity, a wildlife advocacy group that's filed numerous lawsuits to force wildlife services to include the most recent science on predator control in their plans.
Like in Wyoming, which is relying on science primarily from, you know, 70s, the 80s, maybe the early 90s, that just isn't okay.
And more judges agree. California, Arizona, and Idaho all are now required to change their plans to include more non-lethal approaches. And Adkins hopes Wyoming will be next.
In this last decade, we really have seen this growing body of literature that points to the effectiveness of non-lethal methods, for example, using guard dogs or fencing or frightening devices.
We've used noisemakers and sirens, and they work for a period of time. And then the coyotes realize that they're not going to get hurt.
That's Rod Merrill with Wildlife Services in Wyoming. He says killing coyotes still works best. But the researchers in the canyon say they're trying something new, studying coyotes alive. After the two coyotes are weighed and collared, it's time to release them into the wild. Researcher Taylor Lashar is teaching a classmate how to do that.
When I'm ready and you say you're ready to go, then you'll take your hands back really fast and I'll kind of push them. They run really fast. Yeah. Like, you ready? Yeah. Okay.
The coyote springs away from their hands, looks back, confused at his freedom. Then he's gone. For NPR News, I'm Melody Edwards, outside Rock Springs, Wyoming.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is WBUR and online at WBUR.org. In the forecast, it'll be mostly cloudy tonight with rain and possible thunderstorms moving in just after the evening commute. Temperatures should be in the 60s. Right now, 78 degrees in Boston at 449.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Russell's Garden Center. Plants, bird, and garden accessories, a curated artisanal shopping experience for outdoor living spaces, growing with you for 143 years. And Akamai, providers of their intelligent edge security platform for threat protection that comes with over 300 security researchers. Learn more at Akamai, akamai.com/security. Akamai, intelligent security starts at the edge.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Listener support keeps WBUR independent.
If you made a contribution to WBUR this year, your employer might match your gift. Many companies have a June 30th deadline to request a match, so act now to make the most of your support. To learn more, call 1-800-909-9287 or go to WBUR.org. And from all of us at WBUR, thank you.
This is WBUR's All Things Considered. I'm Jack Lepiarz, in for Lisa Mullins. The Boston Red Sox are bringing David Ortiz to Boston for medical care after the retired slugger was shot in the Dominican Republic last night. Speaking with the media a short time ago, Red Sox president Sam Kennedy called Ortiz one of the most beloved and important players in Red Sox history.
It's hard to express what David Ortiz means to the Boston Red Sox. When you love someone and they come in harm's way, it's jarring.
Ortiz's injuries are more serious than originally reported, but he is expected to recover. WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer joins us now in the studio with the latest. Shira, welcome.
Thanks.
So what's the latest here from Red Sox officials and their plan to bring David Ortiz back to Boston?
Well, they didn't reveal any new specifics about Ortiz's condition, but Red Sox doctors have been in contact with doctors in the Dominican Republic, and there's some good news that came out of what Sam Kennedy said about the plan from this point forward.
Our medical team here in Boston and the doctors in the Dominican Republic have confirmed that David's condition is still serious, but that he is stable enough to be transported back here to Boston for continued care. In coordination with our medical team, the club has arranged for a medical air ambulance to transport David to Boston from Santo Domingo. Our hope is that David will arrive here in Boston sometime later tonight.
And when he does arrive back in Boston, he will be treated at Mass General.
What do we know about his injuries and the surgery that he's undergone?
Well, he was shot in the lower back at close range. The bullet exited the abdomen. Initially, Ortiz's father said that the bullet didn't damage any major organs. That was sort of in the initial frenzy after the shooting. But a spokesman for Ortiz says that doctors removed his gallbladder and part of his intestines, and that he also suffered liver damage. Again, the Red Sox wouldn't release any more information about his medical condition. Sam Kennedy expressed thanks to the surgeons in the Dominican Republic who operated on Ortiz.
Now, we know there is one man in custody in connection with this shooting. What have you learned about him and any potential motive?
Well, he's 25 years old. We don't know his actual alleged role in the shooting or possible motive. Don't even know if Ortiz was the intended target. There may have been more than one perpetrator as well. And Red Sox execs didn't go into anything about the shooting and said their sole focus has been on Ortiz's health and the logistics of getting him to Boston for continued medical care. So still awaiting more details on the actual investigation of the shooting.
That's WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, thanks.
Thank you.
And Dominicans in the Boston area are reacting with sadness to the shooting. WBUR Simone Rios brings us to a barber shop in Boston's South End where David Ortiz has often gotten his hair cut.
Walk into MLB Barbershop on Tremont Street, and you can't avoid the presence of Big Papi even if you try. There's a massive cutout of Papi on the wall, a Big Papi street sign, and a mock-up of the iconic Beatles Abbey Road cover, with Papi in the place of John Lennon. One of the barbers at MLB is Gino Almonte, who lives just down the street in Roxbury. I'm worried, Almonte says. A guy like David, he's someone everyone likes. He treats people well. Now everybody's talking about what happened, watching the news, checking our phones for updates on his health. The owner of MLB Barbershop is Jose de la Rosa, known in the community as Bacano. He's been cutting Papi's hair since 2004, when the Red Sox won the World Series for the first time in 86 years. De la Rosa says he feels down today. He describes Ortiz as a friend, a brother. He says Ortiz gave him the keys to his house, and he can come and go as he pleases. De la Rosa has worked as a clubhouse barber at Fenway Park for 10 years and says he continues to cut Ortiz's hair when he's in Boston. With news of the shooting, he called Ortiz's father and was relieved to hear his friend was expected to recover. Ortiz was shot outside a nightclub. For De La Rosa, it's another reminder of the daily reality of life in his native Dominican Republic. Insecurity has gotten out of control, De La Rosa says. I think the lack of education is the biggest problem, and the politicians, the people in charge, they don't fix the problem. For the youth, there's no work, no future, so they take to the streets to see if they can improve their situation. De La Rosa says he has a message to send Ortiz about hanging out around nightclubs. I hope he gets well soon and takes it a little bit easier, De La Rosa says. He doesn't need to go to places like that anymore. He should be with his family. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Simon Rios.
State leaders are pleased that another big company is being lured away from Connecticut to set up shop here in Massachusetts. Raytheon Technologies will be formed from the merger of Waltham-based Raytheon and Connecticut-based United Technologies, and the new defense giant will be headquartered in Massachusetts. WBUR's Steve Brown looks at what's making the Bay State an attractive place for businesses to call home.
Governor Baker says his office did not take part in discussions between Raytheon and United Technologies, and so did not attempt to lure the headquarters to Massachusetts. He did have a conversation with Raytheon executives over the weekend.
One of the things that made this whole thing work was the reputation of the people in Massachusetts, their work ethic, their creativity, their imagination, and frankly, the tremendous pool of really talented STEM students and people who currently work in those fields.
It's the most recent blow for Connecticut and a win for Massachusetts in recent years. In 2016, General Electric pulled up stakes from its longtime home in the Nutmeg State and moved its headquarters to Boston. More recently, MassMutual shut down an office in Enfield, Connecticut, while expanding in Massachusetts. During a conference call with investors, United Technologies CEO Greg Hayes downplayed the significance of the headquarters move.
Raytheon Technologies, as will be called, will be headquartered in the greater Boston metro area. Now, we want to emphasize, particularly for the benefit of United Technologies employees, this does not mean that we're exiting operations in Connecticut and moving to Boston. In fact, Raytheon Technologies will maintain a strong presence in Connecticut for years to come.
But Mark Gallagher of the Massachusetts High Technology Council says companies are increasingly sensitive to some of the tax pressure that they're feeling in states like Connecticut.
And I think conversely, Massachusetts has worked really hard over the last couple of decades to shed the Taxachusetts moniker that did not help us attract business a couple of decades ago. And based on some good policy-making decisions, we've ended up in a place where the tax burden here is, we land pretty squarely in the middle.
Gallagher says Connecticut's tax policies have shifted over the past few decades and believes they have become more burdensome for businesses. But he adds favorable tax policy isn't the only reason why companies relocate here. Quality of life, along with a strong talent pool, are also attractive to businesses. He says Massachusetts has to seize on those advantages to keep the momentum going.
Avoid self-inflicted wounds. And really, part of our biggest challenge is avoiding complacency and really managing the growth we have so that we leverage it and don't choke on it.
The vast majority of United Technologies jobs in Connecticut will remain in Connecticut. Officials say only about 100 top executive jobs will move to the Boston area. The deal still must be approved by shareholders and the federal government. It's expected the new company will have a value of over $100 billion. The deal is expected to be finalized during the first half of 2020. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Steve Brown.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers, from foodies to travelers. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA, N.A. Teradata, committed to transforming the way business works through the power of data. Teradata leverages data across the enterprise on a single platform to deliver answers to today's complex business issues. Teradata.com. And visit St. Pete Clearwater, home of 35 miles of white sand beaches and a daily sunset celebration on Clearwater Beaches Pier 60, 90 miles west of Orlando. at visitstpeteclearwater.com.
In the forecast, mostly cloudy tonight with rain and possible thunderstorms, temperatures in the 60s. Right now, 78 degrees in Boston at 459.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by The Cabot in Beverly with the Taj Mahal Quartet. The Grammy-winning blues singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist plays Thursday, July 18th. Tickets at thecabot.org.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston.
92.7 WBUA Tisbury.
89.1 WBUH Brewster.
Streaming at WBUR.org.
And live at City Space, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR. Boston's NPR News Station.
The former White House counsel under Richard Nixon testifies before Congress as the Justice Department agrees to turn over evidence from the Russia investigation. It's Monday, June 10th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good afternoon. I'm Jack Lepiarz, in for Lisa Mullins. Coming up, John Dean's testimony before the House Judiciary Committee, where Democrats had called him to speak about possible obstruction of justice by the president.
This committee does have a role, and it is adding something that the special counsel could not, and that's public education.
Also this hour, why the University of Alabama's law school is returning a more than $26 million donation. At major protests in Hong Kong, as China's government considers a law to allow for extradition from the city to the mainland. It's 5:01. First, this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is sounding confident that the deal with Mexico to stem the flow of migrants will make a difference, and soon. He spoke at the State Department today, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Pompeo says the U.S. will work closely with its neighbor to make sure Mexico follows up on its pledge to beef up security along its own southern border. For its part, the U.S. will expand a program to return asylum seekers to Mexico, where they'll have to await the adjudication of their claims.
We were able to do this to the tune of a couple of hundred people per day. We now have the capacity to do this full throttle and engage this in a way that will make a fundamental difference in the calculus for those deciding to transit Mexico to try to get into the United States.
Pompeo says the U.S. could still impose tariffs on Mexico if there's no progress. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
House Judiciary Chair Jerry Nadler says for now, Democrats won't hold a vote on whether to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt now that the Justice Department agreed to turn over some underlying evidence from former Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report. That includes files used to assess whether President Trump obstructed justice. Meanwhile, former Nixon administration White House Counsel John Dean told the committee today he sees parallels between the Watergate investigation and the findings in Mueller's probe, including the use of pardons and efforts to seize control of investigations. In New York City, a helicopter crash-landed on the roof of a skyscraper in Manhattan. NPR's Hansilo Wong reports the pilot of the helicopter was killed while attempting to land.
The helicopter made a forced landing on top of an office building known as the AXA Equitable Center in Midtown Manhattan. It's about a block away from Radio City Music Hall and blocks away from Trump Tower. The crash took place on a rainy day with dense fog. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo gave an update shortly after the crash.
There was a fire that happened when the helicopter hit the roof. People who were in the building said they felt the building shake.
The building was evacuated and the fire has been extinguished. Firefighters acted quickly to contain fuel that leaked from the helicopter. Police temporarily stopped traffic in the streets near the building, which is in a popular tourist area just north of Times Square. Hansilo Wong, NPR News, New York.
Former Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli has been named acting director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the agency that manages legal immigration. This despite deep opposition from key Senate Republicans. Cuccinelli is an outspoken supporter of President Trump's immigration policies, but getting the job permanently would require Senate confirmation, and that could be tough since Cuccinelli has been highly critical of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and his leadership team. Wall Street higher by the closing bell, the Dow up 78 points, the Nasdaq up 81, the S&P 500 up 13 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. Players and management for the Red Sox are reacting with shock and sadness to last night's shooting that seriously injured former designated hitter David Ortiz. Ortiz was shot through the back while at a club in the Dominican Republic. An Ortiz spokesman says he had surgery to remove his gallbladder, parts of his colon, and parts of his intestines. Red Sox manager Alex Cora, who played with Ortiz, says he means a lot to him and the Red Sox community.
I don't know if here they said, you know, but back home, you know, they talk about superheroes without capes. And he's a superhero without cape. That's the way we see him, you know.
Ortiz is expected to arrive in Boston later this evening for continued medical treatment. Waltham-based Raytheon Union employees say they've been left in the dark about their company's pending merger. WBUR's Jerome Campbell reports.
Union business manager Michael Zagama says he learned about the merger like everybody else, on the news. Raytheon plans to merge with Connecticut-based United Technologies, which has a market value twice as large as Raytheon. Zagama says he remembers when Raytheon acquired a defense company in 1997 and laid off thousands of workers across the state.
That's our experience with mergers with Raytheon. If they make a lot of promises, obviously they break them.
Company executives say they expect the merger will create new jobs. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jerome Campbell.
Shares in Raytheon rose nearly 1% in trading today. Shares in United Technology fell 3%. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is eliminating the cabinet position of education chief, a position that he created when he took office in 2014. Walsh tells WBUR's education team, Edify, the position makes less sense now, so he won't appoint another person for the foreseeable future. That comes as Brenda Casilius takes over as the new superintendent of Boston Public Schools. In sports, the Red Sox will start a four-game set with the Texas Rangers at Fenway tonight. Chris Sale on the mound. In the forecast, mostly cloudy tonight with rain and possible thunderstorms moving in after the evening commute. Temperatures in the 60s. Right now, 78 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Brigham Health Neurosurgery, dedicated to providing advanced patient-focused care for the entire spectrum of neurological diseases. Neurosurgery.brighamandwomens.org. And Tire Rack. For the past 40 years, Tire Rack has remained committed to helping people find the right tires, wheels, and performance parts. Learn more at TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, and install.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Today, the House Judiciary Committee began hearings on lessons from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on Russia's election interference. Also today, Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler announced a breakthrough in talks with the Justice Department to hand over evidence Mueller used to draw his conclusions. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis joins us now on the latest from Capitol Hill. And Sue, let's start with that agreement reached between the Judiciary Committee and DOJ. What are the terms?
So in a statement, Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler said that DOJ agreed to turn over, in his words, key evidence that was used in its investigation over whether or not President Trump obstructed justice. We don't know explicitly what this evidence is. It's always important to remember that Mueller did not draw a conclusion on whether or not the president obstructed justice. In the report, it made a point to say the president was not exonerated on this front and kind of turned it over to Congress for their oversight capabilities. Nadler said this evidence should start coming over as early as today. He said every member on the panel will be able to view it, and it will continue to be part of their ongoing investigation.
If there is a deal, will Democrats call off that vote tomorrow to hold Attorney General Barr in civil contempt?
No, it's still on. It's really important to make a distinction here, though. So what the judiciary did back in May, the committee, is they did vote to hold Barr in contempt of Congress. That is not what's going to be coming to the floor tomorrow. What Democrats are bringing to the floor tomorrow essentially authorizes the Judiciary Committee to fight the Attorney General and other people in the administration in civil court to enforce their subpoenas. It's a type of civil contempt. Nadler says if Barr and DOJ complies with this request, they're not going to have to take that route, but they're not going to take the pressure off. The resolution also applies to former White House counsel Don McGahn and testimony and documents they're seeking from him. I also think it's important to see this vote happening tomorrow is, you know, a bit about politics. Democrats are still pretty divided over whether to move formally with an impeachment inquiry. It does give Democrats a chance to go on the record and say they are doing something to hold this administration accountable. It is not legally necessary in order to fight it in the courts, but it does give them a little bit of oomph.
In the meantime, the Judiciary Committee launched its oversight investigation into Robert Mueller's report. Then we turn on C-SPAN, and basically we see the former Nixon White House counsel, John Dean. I mean, he was a key witness in the Watergate scandal testifying. So why did they call him?
You know, they're clearly trying to draw a parallel here between Nixon, what Nixon was to Watergate. Democrats are saying Mueller could be to President Trump. Dean did invoke Watergate in saying that the Mueller report could be seen as a, quote, roadmap for impeachment. This is a term that was used for a secret report that was written by Watergate prosecutor Leon Jaworski, who provided a report to the House Judiciary Committee that kind of said, here's the case, now you go make it. The top Republican on the committee, Doug Collins, he's a Republican from Georgia, kind of made the point about this panel of hearings is, so what, right? Like, none of the witnesses at the hearing today were involved in the Mueller investigation. There was also a couple former federal prosecutors that testified. There were not substantial fact witnesses in the investigation into either the interference or the administration. It wasn't that dissimilar, Collins said, to listening to people on a cable news panel talk about what they think should happen. We should note that Dean is often seen on cable news talking about this very matter. But it also serves as a reminder that Democrats have had a hard time, you know, getting people in the Trump administration to come up and testify about the Mueller report. They've really struck out so far. So this is in some ways seen as the best they could do as a starting point. Nadler says he's still confident Bob Mueller is going to come up and testify before the committee in public, even though Mueller has said he does not want to do that. Jerry Nadler has not ruled out using a subpoena if he won't, but he still says he's not willing to go there just yet.
That's NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The biggest donor in the history of the University of Alabama says the school is choosing, quote, zealotry over the well-being of its students. The donor is Florida businessman Hugh Culverhouse. Last year, he pledged $26.5 million to the university. On Friday, the Board of Trustees voted to give it back, all the money he's given so far, and to remove his name from its law school. The reason? His objections to Alabama's controversial new law banning nearly all abortions in the state. At least, that is the reason, according to Culverhouse. The university says it was Culverhouse's desire to influence hiring, firing, and admissions on campus. And the university has released emails showing the return of Culverhouse's gift was under consideration days before he weighed in on abortion. Culverhouse wrote about all this in an op-ed published by The Washington Post, and he spoke with us today about it. I asked him why he thinks the decision was tied to his stance on abortion.
First, the timing. Second, the timing. Third, the timing.
And the timing, as you see it, was what?
Well, the timing, as I see it, was a matter of hours. My press release came out, and with a short period of time, the chancellor's statement came out in which he said he was returning the money, and he said the day before they had decided to return the money. I don't believe that. I believe if they had decided to return the money, they would have returned it before.
I just want to make sure I understand. So you're saying you made public remarks laying out how clearly you disagree with the Alabama state law on abortion, and that after that, the university said, here's all your money, take it back. Thanks, but no thanks.
Correct.
So reconcile that with this email that I'm looking at. I'm looking at a copy of an email dated Saturday, May 25th. It's from you to the president of the University of Alabama, Stuart Bell. Subject line, return of $10 million paid in advance. You're asking for money back. This was an email dated 5 days before your public remarks on abortion.
Yes. Can I explain that?
Please.
Okay. The $10 million was money I had paid in advance of the schedule. It was not asking to be paid back 21 and a half. It was my statement that you have not spent any money out of $21.5 million. Some of the money being there for 20 months. If you're going to sit there and not do scholarships and professorships, then return the $10 million I advanced, and I'll pay it back to you over the schedule.
I suppose the broader point being, without getting deep into the weeds of what check was dated when, there appears to be a paper trail documenting disagreement and rancor that predates your public remarks on abortion.
Well, the issue I had, the big issue was I felt the class sizes were too small. They were denying to Alabama students access But at some point, the dean agreed to increase the starting class by 8%. That resolved my major issue.
It sounds as though you believe that with your money, with your gift, should come some say into how the law school is run?
Sure. If you look at my speech when it was announced, I clearly stated I intend to be intimately involved. I'm not giving the money to have my name on a building. None of the money I've ever given is that way. I don't give for buildings.
I'm sure it's crossed your mind, Mr. Culverhouse, that the losers here are going to be the current and future students of the University of Alabama.
Yeah, and that's sad. My whole goal is to create a middle class, because we are losing it. The middle class is becoming the upper lower class. I'm fortunate. My dad worked for the IRS. We weren't born into money, but we worked our way into it. Everybody should have that same chance that I did. He did.
Hugh Culverhouse, the Florida real estate investor who gave $26.5 million to the University of Alabama, talking with us there about the school's decision to give it back. Mr. Culverhouse, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, for more on this, we turn to NPR's Debbie Elliott in Orange Beach, Alabama. Hi, Deb.
Hello.
Hello. So 2 points. One, for the sake of disclosure, I should mention you are a University of Alabama grad.
True.
Second, what does the university have to say about Culverhouse's allegations of retaliation?
Well, the university's position is that Culverhouse is somehow trying to rewrite history by injecting, quote, one of society's most emotional, divisive issues, end quote, into what was really a dispute over his attempts to influence academic policy. And you know, Culverhouse has been getting a lot of national press since he called on students to boycott the university on May 29th. That was 2 weeks after the governor signed that abortion ban into law. And now, as you noted before the interview with Culverhouse, we know from email records released by the school that Culverhouse himself had first asked for some of that donation back well before that.
Right. And you've looked at all that email evidence that I was coming through today as well. What leapt out at you?
Well, I think the fact that days before Culverhouse called for the boycott, there was this email traffic that the chancellor and attorneys had decided to return his donation and take his name off of the law school. Now, that email chain also included some of Culverhouse's missives to school officials. He was trying to have a say in who was hired for a constitutional law professorship named for him. And he belittled the dean of the law school in several emails. I'm going to quote one of them. He said that this dean, quote, would always be a small town insecure dean and the outside world frightens him. Now, I spoke with a law professor who says faculty at the Alabama Law School had concerns about Culverhouse's efforts long before this dispute, that his efforts to intervene in academic policy date back as far as February. This professor also questioned why the University of Alabama should take the blame for a law passed by state lawmakers when several professors at the law school had spoken out against the abortion ban. So I think the broader question here is, you know, how much control does a mega donor deserve?
Right, indeed. And two very different and conflicting views on that, it sounds like, playing out there in Alabama. NPR's Debbie Elliott, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Olive Tomlinson of East Chop. WBUR is on the Cape and Islands at 89.1 and 92.7 FM and always on the WBUR Listen app.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Cityside Subaru in Belmont, where the Love Spring event is underway. CitysideSubaru.com, the beauty of all-wheel drive, the beauty of springtime. And Turco Legal, Massachusetts divorce and family law attorneys, guiding clients through complex legal issues. Learn more at Turco, T-U-R-C-O Legal.com.
Coming up on WBUR's All Things Considered, what Huawei is saying about international security concerns as the company tries to expand overseas. On Wall Street today was a positive day for the markets. The Dow rose 78 points to 26,062. NASDAQ was up 81 points at 7,823. S&P 500 up 13 points at 2,886. In the forecast, it'll be a mixed bag this week, starting with showers and possible storms tonight. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
The clouds continue to thicken up during the evening. It remains mild overnight tonight. We're going to stay in the 60s as humidity levels are high. Showers and even a couple of thunderstorms roll in. Eastern Massachusetts after 7 o'clock. We'll look for those showers to move into western areas a little earlier. For tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms. Could be some heavy downpours the first part of the day. Temperatures in the upper 70s, approaching 80. Wednesday, sunshine's back. It's drier, mid-70s. Thursday, showers, damp, upper 60s. It's cool with the wind off the water. Friday, mostly sunny, lower 70s.
Right now, it's 79 degrees in Boston at 520.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from CDW. IT orchestration by CDW brings together experts, technologies, and partners to turn complexity into simplicity. CDW, people who get it. And Focus features With the Dead Don't Die, a comedy from director Jim Jarmusch about one town's fight against the zombie apocalypse. Starring Bill Murray, Adam Driver, Tilda Swinton, and Chloe Sevigny in theaters Friday.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. And let's consider the case against Huawei. The U.S. is waging a campaign against the Chinese tech giant, a global campaign. It wants to stop companies from working with Huawei. It wants allies to keep Huawei out of the next generation of digital networks because of fears that China's government could use Huawei to hack those networks. Steve Inskeep of NPR's Morning Edition has been asking how real the risk is. He's back in our studio. Welcome.
Hey there, Mary Louise.
Hey. So what made you want to take a closer look at Huawei?
It is a symbol of the wider conflict between the U.S. and China. We've been looking at people with a foot in both worlds, both countries, as they pull apart. And what drives a lot of the disputes, the trade war and many other things, is the fact that there are two different systems. In this case, a Chinese company wants to do business in the U.S. and elsewhere, even though it's operating under that very different system.
Okay, so you got to see a few of Huawei's different sites on your recent reporting trip to China. Take me there. What equipment do they make that is so sensitive?
We got a look on a factory floor at one of the most basic things they make. We were at a Huawei assembly line in southern China. Big concrete floor. It's really clean, huge, mostly automated.
There goes a little Huawei robot carrying one of these boxes to its destination while playing music.
So it doesn't surprise the few people who are moving around. Now, the assembly line is making these plastic boxes and wrapping them for shipment. They are base stations which send and receive data from your smartphone. Huawei also makes antennas to receive these signals and millions of smartphones, lots of stuff, reports huge profits, and it has headquarters in southern China that really flaunt that wealth.
And where exactly in southern China?
In Shenzhen, which is China's version of Silicon Valley. It's a city that didn't even exist a few decades ago, and now it's vast. And we went to this Huawei campus of sprawling buildings.
The scale of this, the marble, the stone, feels a little like the Palace of Versailles. If the Palace of Versailles had, I don't know, a 30-foot-high video screen?
And this giant screen was showing colorful scenes of life in cities. It was at the entrance to this display hall, almost like a Huawei museum, showing what the company wants to do in cities.
This is one of three exhibition halls we have on campus.
You're hearing Joe Kelly, former tech journalist who now works for the company. He says networks run with Huawei equipment can coordinate traffic in a city or allow trash cans to tell the city when they're full or let police get real-time data on crimes.
All of the video feeds can be analyzed by the central control unit, and it simply allows the organization to control things faster.
I'm looking at a map here of the world. This is places where you've already sold some of these.
These are places where we have implemented either smart or safe city solutions.
Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, correct. Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, needless to say.
Bolivia, Argentina, Netherlands, London.
Everywhere. So all kinds of networks and all kinds of sensitive data traversing those networks.
Which explains why the U.S. is alleging Huawei can't be trusted to touch that data because China's government might ask Huawei for intelligence information. President Trump said it this way in May.
Huawei is something that's very dangerous. You look at what they've done from a security standpoint, from a military standpoint, it's very dangerous. So,
but the president went right on to say he might back off Huawei as part of some larger trade deal.
At the very same event, same press conference?
The same sentence as he went on a little bit, yeah.
Which makes it sound like the president thinks Huawei is not such a security threat. I mean, what exactly is the danger as you've been able to look at it?
Well, the best publicly available information on this is not in the United States or China. It's actually in the UK, which looks closely at Huawei because it's a global company. They do business there. So we made a Skype call to Britain. Mr. Woodward.
Good morning.
That's Alan Woodward, who's a professor who has consulted with UK internet security officials. I asked him what somebody abusing Huawei gear might be able to do to me.
It's not really what they could do to you. I think one needs to look at it in a slightly different way.
Woodward is not that worried about Huawei equipment being used to spy on individuals, because if somebody wanted to hack your data, there are probably easier ways to do that, unfortunately.
Sure.
But suppose some secret backdoor let people crack into Huawei gear. Hackers might disrupt the network, make it crash. So to avoid that risk, Britain set up a special evaluation center to examine Huawei products.
And they strip it all back and they look at the software and the hardware, and they make sure that there are no security flaws in it, no back doors, nothing like that.
And what'd they find? Did they find a back door?
They have not, so far as we know, but a report from the British evaluators did find baffling security flaws in a particular kind of software that tells Huawei gear what to do.
Everybody already knew there was a security problem. So why that was being used, nobody could understand.
In some other cases, Huawei sent one kind of software to be tested in the UK and then sold a different version of it to British companies, which suggests that it's not really being tested at all, makes it more vulnerable to hackers. Huawei did promise British security officials to improve quality control, Woodward says.
But what was reported by the National Center for Cybersecurity was that they had seen no tangible progress.
What does Huawei say to all this?
Well, we heard an answer when we were at the corporate headquarters in China, and we talked through an interpreter with Catherine Chen. She's on Huawei's board. She's been a company employee for decades. And we discussed a Huawei promise to spend $2 billion upgrading security.
We have to make further improvements and up our game in terms of improving the security engineering capability and security technologies.
Now, we should mention that whatever Huawei may do, however it may invest, the real Western fear is from China's government. Mm-hmm. Could it lean on Huawei to manipulate the internet somehow? And in response to that, Catherine Chen quoted Ren Zhengfei, who is the company founder.
Mr. Ren has said publicly that in the past there has never been any request made by any government, including Chinese government, to implant backdoors. And he even goes further to say that if in the future there were such kind of requests, he would rather shut down the company than to comply with those requests.
But is it entirely up to Huawei? As you know from reporting there, China's government is intertwined with the private sector and commerce in all kinds of ways.
And that's the main reason the United States says it does not want Huawei selling equipment for the next generation internet network known as 5G. But Huawei is still thinking globally, which we could see on another of their several campuses while we were in southern China. This campus is in the city of Dongguan, and the campus is so vast that you have to ride from one place to another on a train. That is the sound of the red antique-style commuter train pulling into the station where we boarded, which was in Paris.
In Paris. So we've moved inward from Versailles right into central Paris.
So. Okay. This campus in China is designed to look like historic sites in a series of European cities, including Paris, and these cities were visible outside the train window.
Heidelberg Castle, okay. The turret there.
People are crossing a river on an arched stone bridge lined with street lamps. There was a cobblestone street leading toward a tower in Bologna, Italy.
Paris is behind us. Who knows what's in front of us?
This company has worldwide ambitions, whether the United States wants to restrain it or not.
Steve Inskeep of our sister program, Morning Edition, sharing some of his reporting from China. Thank you.
You're welcome.
He has been reporting on people with a foot in two worlds, and there's more tomorrow morning. What are we going to hear?
Descendants of Chinese immigrants who built a famous American railroad, the Transcontinental Railroad.
All right, we'll be listening.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR, online at WBUR.org. Coming up on All Things Considered, hundreds of thousands of people protest in Hong Kong over proposed changes to the law that could allow them to be extradited to the mainland. Remember, WBUR occasionally offers you the opportunity to win prizes in conjunction with our fundraising efforts. While a pledge is appreciated, it is not required to win a prize from WBUR. Employees of WBUR and associated sweepstakes entities are not eligible for any drawings or contests. Complete rules are at WBUR.org. In the forecast, we'll see clouds and rain and possible thunderstorms tonight, moving in just after the evening commute, temperatures in the 60s. Rain for tomorrow morning, then clouds in the afternoon, highs in the upper 70s. Right now, 78 degrees in Boston at 5:30.
The Southern Baptist Convention is having a reckoning over sexual abuse.
Can we trust our church leaders to not only not be abusing, but to also be prohibiting people who could be abusers from having a place where they can do it with impunity?
Do women in the church have any power?
I think there's just something about the order of creation that means that God intends for the preaching voice to be a male voice.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR News station.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The U.S. Supreme Court has refused to hear a challenge to the federal law regulating the use of gun silencers. The court's action came just days after a gunman used a silencer in a shooting spree in Virginia Beach that killed 12 people. NPR's Nina Totenberg has the latest.
The justices, without comment, let stand the conviction of two men who were convicted of violating the federal law on gun silencers. The 85-year-old law imposes a tax and registration requirement on the sale of silencers. The men were convicted after a jury trial and sentenced to probation. They appealed their convictions, arguing that the law violated their Second Amendment right to bear arms. Seven states joined in asking the court to hear the case: Texas, South Carolina, Montana, Louisiana, Utah, Arkansas, and Idaho. The Trump administration defended the convictions, asking the court to stay out of the case. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
In New York City, a helicopter pilot was killed today trying to make a crash landing on top of a Manhattan skyscraper. The building was evacuated and the fire was quickly extinguished. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio says it's unclear what caused the crash, but there's no further threat to the area.
There is no indication at this time that this was an act of terror, and there is no ongoing threat to New York City based on all the information we have right now.
The chopper was flying during rain and heavy clouds over Manhattan. Police temporarily stopped traffic in the streets near the building in Midtown, which is in a popular tourist area just north of Times Square. The name of the pilot has yet to be released. Stocks finished higher on Wall Street, extending their recent gains as shares of General Motors and Ford got a boost after the U.S. dropped plans to impose tariffs on Mexican goods. The Dow gained 78 points, up 0.3%. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. Retired Red Sox legend David Ortiz is expected to be back in Boston tonight. He was shot last night in the Dominican Republic. WBUR's Jerome Campbell has the latest from an update from Red Sox leadership.
Members of the Red Sox front office say Ortiz is in serious condition but stable enough to be transported for continued care at Mass General Hospital. Doctors remove Ortiz's gallbladder and part of his intestine after he was shot at point-blank range at a bar. Police say the gunman is in custody and the motive is unknown. Team President Sam Kennedy thanks Red Sox fans for supporting the legend who supported the city after the Boston Marathon bombing.
When we needed David Ortiz the most, he was there for us. So it's appropriate and expected that this community would rally around David when he needs us the most.
Kennedy adds, Red Sox medical staff are doing everything they can to aid Ortiz's recovery. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jerome Campbell.
A preliminary assessment of Saturday's Green Line train derailment on the D branch points to the operator. More now from WBUR's Fred Tice.
The train derailed where the C and D branches split, just beyond Kenmore Square. There's an elaborate set of switches at that point. Deputy General Manager Jeff Gonneville told the T's Fiscal and Management Control Board this afternoon that the track and switch in this area were replaced 2 years ago.
Preliminarily, we have done an assessment into this incident, and at this point we have ruled out both the vehicle and the infrastructure as a cause of this incident. And at this point in time, it does appear to be operator-related.
10 people were taken to hospitals after the derailment. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Fred Tice.
For the seventh time this year, TSA officers at Logan Airport have found a gun in carry-on luggage. Agency says the latest discovery was over the weekend when screeners using an X-ray machine found a loaded handgun. The passenger was issued a summons and the gun was confiscated. He says he had forgotten the gun was with him. State regulators say Massachusetts has one of the lowest rates in the country for minors successfully purchasing alcohol from a bar or liquor store. State Treasury says only 3% of the more than 1,000 locations failed a compliance check. That is 12% better than the national average. Gas prices in Massachusetts are down 4 cents from last week. AAA Northeast says the average price for regular unleaded gas now $2.71 per gallon. In the forecast, it'll be mostly cloudy tonight with rain and possible thunderstorms moving in just after the evening commute. Temperatures in the 60s. Rain for tomorrow morning and then clouds for the afternoon. Still a lot of humidity out there with highs in the upper 70s. Sunny skies for Wednesday, highs in the mid-70s. Thursday, more showers and cooler, highs in the upper 60s. Friday looks to be mostly sunny. We'll see highs in the lower 70s, and the weekend looks to start sunny and dry as well. Right now, it's 78 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform, featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at zoom.us. And Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at indeed.com/hire.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Audie Cornish. In Hong Kong Sunday, hundreds of thousands of people filled the city streets to protest a proposed government law that would allow people to be extradited to mainland China for criminal charges.
No extradition to China!
Despite the large response against the proposed law, Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, is still pushing to pass the law by next month. We go now to Alan Wong. He's deputy editor of Inkstone News in Hong Kong. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Alan, if you could start just by describing what it was like on the streets this weekend.
Right. On Sunday afternoon, hundreds of thousands of people started marching from Victoria Park to the Hong Kong government headquarters. And there were so many people that people were stuck in metro stations for hours. The crowd was moving at a glacial pace. Normally, a block in Causeway Bay would take maybe 30 seconds to cross, but on Sunday, it took 15 minutes. The size of the crowd invigorated all protesters because they had never seen anything like this since 2014, when Hong Kong had the umbrella revolution calling for democracy.
Can you help us understand why so many everyday people are worried about a law that's about the extradition of criminal suspects?
Right. The hundreds of thousands of people who took to the streets worried that they could be extradited for charges that are purely fictional or drummed up for political reasons.
You've described this mass protest, a lot of displeasure with this law. Why is Carrie Lam still pushing it through?
Well, the official answer is that there's a recent murder case that happened in Taiwan, and the suspect is a Hong Kong resident who has returned to Hong Kong. But he cannot be sent back to Taiwan to stand trial because there's no extradition agreement between Taiwan and Hong Kong. Therefore, Hong Kong needs to legislate something to allow that suspect to face justice in Taiwan. But Hong Kong protesters do not think that that is the true motive behind the Hong Kong government's move to push this amendment through.
Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, is appointed by Beijing, correct? And I assume that there's heavy influence within Hong Kong's government as well.
Yes. Carrie Lam, the Hong Kong chief executive, is appointed by Beijing. She was elected not by the general population, but by a small committee made up of mostly business interest groups and elite politicians. So a lot of people during the protest on Sunday actually called for her resignation.
You mentioned the umbrella protest a few years back, and now there are these protests in the streets. Do you get the sense that people in Hong Kong are starting to feel like these kinds of demonstrations aren't effective for them?
They certainly feel that protests have been ineffective, at least since 2003, when a protest with 500,000 participants did force the government to shelve a national security legislation. But in the years since, especially after the Umbrella Movement protests, the Hong Kong protesters have a sense of helplessness. Even though they put up such a strong expression of displeasure at the government's proposed changes to laws or the lack of progress in democratization, the government still wouldn't compromise. Therefore, in recent years, you've seen some participants in protests would turn to violence to express their frustration with the government.
I can see why then this extradition law would be of concern.
Yes, part of the extradition law is applicable to crimes that are punishable by more than 7 years of imprisonment. Rioting would be included.
That's Alan Wong, deputy editor of Inkstone News in Hong Kong. Thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Now to Sudan and day two of a civil disobedience campaign aimed at forcing the ruling military junta to give up power and hand it over to a civilian government. And this comes 1 week after troops forcefully broke up a sit-in at the defense ministry. Dozens of people were killed. That sit-in had lasted 2 months and had succeeded in the peaceful overthrow of longtime President Omar al-Bashir. It had given protesters hope for democracy. NPR's Eder Peralta is there. He is in the capital, Khartoum. He joins us now. Hey there.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Hi. So what is the scene in Khartoum today? What is the mood among protesters?
So, I mean, it's still a pretty quiet city. About 80% of the stores are closed. It's not like yesterday when the city was a ghost town, but it's not normal. I mean, this is a city that feels under siege. Pretty much every block you drive through or walk through, there are paramilitary troops called the Rapid Support Forces. And they are on tanks and on pickup trucks with machine guns. They're on foot. They're patrolling with sticks and whips. And there's a real palpable fear in the air. I was here about a month ago, and I was talking to people on the streets in the open, and now I'm doing interviews and moving vehicles. That's how scared people are.
People, like, pulling them into the vehicle with you so that you can talk to them?
That's right, because it's hard to talk on the streets because there's so many military men around. And also, you know, the government has shut down most of the internet, so people don't know what's going on, so they're just very fearful. Some of them have just stayed home since the sit-in was broken up last week.
And what about the violence? I mentioned dozens of people were killed. I know there's been some dispute over exactly how many, with the opposition saying more than 100 killed. The government says it's closer to 61, but either way, a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's still happening, the violence, because protesters, they're still continuing to build roadblocks, and the security forces are dispersing them quickly. The government, you know, says that there's nothing going on. Today, they called us to a hospital to show us that it was open and that it was treating patients. And I asked Dr. Mohamed Toum, a government health official, about reports and video that we had seen of troops surrounding hospitals and shooting into them. And this is what he told me.
No, if you find soldiers outside, they are to secure the facility. Because, for example, they need to secure patients, secure the employees, that the doctors or nurses who are working there.
So the troops were protecting the hospitals, he says. But as he said that, two young doctors shook their heads. They told me they couldn't talk to us about it, but it was clear from their faces and from the little that they told me that they did not agree with what this minister was saying.
Mm. And when you talk to people, when you drag them into your moving vehicle with you to just to try to find out what ordinary people are thinking, what do they tell you about what's going on in their country?
A lot of them can't believe what's happening. Khartoum, the capital, has always sort of been insulated from the violence and repression that the rest of the country has had. And this is really the first time that these paramilitary troops have been brought into the capital. And so they can't believe what they've done here, how much carnage they've suffered. And I spoke to this one young woman who says she's leaving Sudan. She was one of the first female protesters on the scene. And she says she's too heartbroken to stay.
Mm. NPR's Eder Peralta reporting from the streets of Khartoum in Sudan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Oregon's criminal justice system will be examined in a Portland courtroom tomorrow. At issue is how the state treats defendants with mental illnesses. The lawsuit accuses Oregon of letting mentally ill people languish in jail rather than provide the health care they need at the state's psychiatric hospital. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson reports.
In December, Carlos Zamora Scar was arrested on a felony burglary charge. Court documents show he was undergoing a severe mental health crisis at the time. A few weeks after his arrest, a judge ordered a psychological evaluation at the Oregon State Hospital. Amanda Thibault is Zamora Scar's criminal defense attorney.
January came and went. February came and went. Then he was just languishing in jail, where a mentally ill person shouldn't be.
In court, he made delirious statements during hearings. So much so that after months in jail, a judge found him unable to aid in his own defense and ordered him this time to receive treatment at the Oregon State Hospital. But for weeks, that didn't happen. It wasn't until late last month that Zamora Scar was finally admitted to the state hospital. The idea is to treat his mental illness until he's able to aid in his defense, and only then, Thibault says, can his criminal case move forward.
This is happening statewide.
Attorneys and mental health experts say right now there are about 40 people like Zamora Scar with mental health issues who are waiting in Oregon jails to get transferred to the state hospital for treatment. Emily Cooper is the legal director for Disability Rights Oregon, a nonprofit that sued the state nearly 20 years ago over the same issue and won.
People with mental illness don't belong in places that are intended to punish. They should be in places that are designed to treat.
In 2002, a federal judge found the state can't keep people in county jails for more than 7 days when a state court judge has found they need to be at the state psychiatric hospital.
It's not happening.
For years it was, but in the last year or so, Cooper says the state has a backlog because it's lost control of the situation.
The problem is nationally and here in Oregon, we haven't appropriately funded a community behavioral health system to meet the needs of those individuals. And so what's happened, again, here in Oregon and nationally, is jails have become the de facto mental health provider.
And that's, to a large extent, very true.
Captain Lee Eby is the jail commander in Clackamas County, Oregon. He says he regularly has people in his jail who are waiting past the 7-day window to be sent to the state hospital for treatment. He says jails have become the new mental hospitals.
And that's not the way it should be. And if there's that one thing I would change, it would be that, is to get away from that notion of criminalizing some of the behavior and not having the resources to deal with it.
The state psychiatric hospital is run by the Oregon Health Authority. Patrick Allen is the agency's director. He acknowledges it's taking longer than 7 days to admit people from jails.
The challenge is that this rate of sending people to us continues to accelerate.
He says he's working to reduce the amount of time people are waiting and to speed up the discharge process for those who no longer need hospital-level care. But Allen says the hospital is also dealing with things that are outside his control.
60% of people referred to us on an aid and assist order were homeless at the time of their arrest. To me, that speaks volumes in terms of the nature of the kind of problem that we're struggling with.
And while Allen says he's doing everything he can, that's of little comfort to those in a jail cell rather than a hospital bed. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR, online at WBUR.org. Coming up on All Things Considered, what it takes to write the music for Sesame Street as the show celebrates its 50th birthday. Visit WBUR.org today for our coverage of the Raytheon United Technologies merger and why it's another big win for Massachusetts. That and more at WBUR.org. Forecast says mostly cloudy tonight with rain and a possible thunderstorm moving in just after the evening commute. Temperatures in the 60s. Rain for tomorrow morning, then clouds for the afternoon. Still a lot of humidity, highs in the upper 70s. Sunny skies on Wednesday, highs in the mid-70s. And Thursday, more showers, highs in the upper 60s. Right now, 78 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Dad, you've washed and waxed this car every weekend since you got it. You're donating it, so who cares?
I'm donating this to WBUR, and I'm not giving a wreck to Robin Young.
If you donate your old car, you'll be supporting the news and programming you love. We'll get top dollar for it, and you may be eligible for a tax deduction. Go to WBUR.org/cars, and thanks from Robin and all of us at WBUR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Recently, we had some special guests here at NPR headquarters.
Today, in honor of Sesame Street's 50th birthday, we are doing a concert. Oh, I am very excited.
That's Count Von Count from Sesame Street. He came to our offices in D.C. to perform a tiny desk concert for NPR Music, along with Elmo, Grover, Big Bird, and more. They did the classics, like Sing. I wanted to learn more about what goes into writing these melodies and lessons today. So I sat down with some of the people behind the songs. Dr. Rosemarie Truglio, Senior Vice President of Curriculum and Content, and Bill Sherman, the music director at Sesame Street. I started by asking Sherman about classic songs like Sing.
When you think of Sesame Street, you think of Being Green and People in Your Neighborhood and Sing and those songs that really made the show iconic. And so, at least as the current music director, you are forever trying to get as close to that if you ever possibly can.
And Rosemarie, can you talk about like the educational component of the songs back then? I mean, they did do kind of curriculum-type work, right? They did sit down with educators. But even back then, I kind of think of a song like Sing or Being Green as just kind of like nice songs.
Well, but think about the lyrics in Sing. It is about the importance of music in your life and that you make music with your voice, and it's about confidence, right?
Sing out strong.
So sing a song and be proud of how you're singing. Don't worry about how your voice sounds. And that's a really important message, especially for parents, because we want parents to sing to their children, talk to their children, read to their children, because we want them to learn words.
Bill Sherman, I think when we think of that classic music, it also was in line with the period in a way, right? Like, people were listening to folk rock music on the radio.
Sure.
And so even though we think of it as old-fashioned, that was like the music of the moment.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Sesame Street, I like to pat myself on the back and say, has done successfully, is sort of, at least sonically, changed with the times. So I think, you know, we sort of defined ourselves in the early days by that, what you call old school or vaudevillian, like that sort of oompa 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 music of you know, C is for cookie.
C is for cookie. That's good enough for me.
And since then, you know, in through the 70s and through the 80s, songs like Pinball Number Count, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Was around during the Pointer Sisters era.
I love
like
that song.
Right?
So I just dated myself.
It's okay. We all, when we talk about Sesame Street, date ourselves at one point or another. So, and then when I took over the job some 10 years ago, I wanted to keep doing that and keep pushing it further. And I play all the songs that I write for my children, and they are two girls aged 6 and 8, Maya and Luna. And Maya and Luna are the best litmus test for what is pop music and what is cool today, because they, whenever they're driving anywhere, are listening to the, you know, the top 40 stations. And so if they don't like my song within the first 10 seconds, I throw it away and start again.
Wow.
Because their ears are so in tune to that kind of music. And I think Rosemary would tell you that our biggest thing is about making sure, at least from a song standpoint, that the kids can remember what we're trying to teach.
I want to walk through the process of writing one of these modern songs, and we're going to do it with a song called Check That Shape.
There on the floor is a shape moving towards me. What is the shape? Tell me, please. Oh, what can it be?
Can you talk about the season's educational goal? So the year you were writing this, like, what was kind of the educational component you were going for?
In this particular case, we're calling out shapes, which are geometric forms. And so a shape gets a shape based on its attributes. So the song is going to call out the number of sides and the number of angles.
All right. So we are going to hear this song performed by pop star Nick Jonas.
1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 sides you can count on. A five-sided shape, well, you know.
So, first of all, this song was kind of sexy in a way that worried me. Can you talk about how the music team picks it up from the educational part, right? How do you then sit down and say, okay, let's figure this out?
So Rosemary and her team of highly qualified educators send me lyrics that have been, you know, vetted and approved and thought through. If you can imagine what this is like on a piece of paper, it says, you know, pentagon, 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 a five-sided shape. Well, you know, it's a pentagon. So I was like, okay. And then at that point, we had booked Nick Jonas, and his voice is so specific, and he's so smooth, and all of his songs are sort of about relationships. And so I made it, like, what you call sexy to me is just like he's enamored with the shapes. He loves the shapes.
Take those shapes.
Rosemary, can you suggest a song that you love? One that you just thought, oh, wow, you guys nailed it.
Count Me In.
Count me in. Count me in.
Can you tell me about it?
It's about diversity, and it's about inclusivity. It's about showing that we're all unique, but yet we're all the same. And I think that's where the beauty comes in that song. And that's something that is really important on Sesame Street, because we want all children to see themselves on Sesame Street.
And Bill Sherman, for you, what is a favorite?
The first song I ever wrote for Sesame Street was called What I Am. Mm-hmm. Was just like this song that we wrote with Will I Am.
There's only one me, I admit. Have a dream, I'll follow it. It's up to me to try.
And it was about, you know, I'm special, I'm this, I'm that, and it was just, it's one of the songs that people ask me about most of all, and I'm pretty proud of that, so that's cool.
What I Am, nice.
And what I am is thoughtful, and what I am is musical, and what I am is smart, and what I am is
at the end of the day, you guys are joining a long legacy, right? What's it like to have that responsibility? I mean, some of the things you inject into little minds, right, can stay with them for a very long time.
It's a big responsibility, because we take it very seriously. Our mission on Sesame Street is to create content to help kids grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. So it's a huge responsibility, because we want to make sure that we then assess later and we see learning impact.
And Bill, for you?
I personally think what we're doing is unbelievably important, and we all know that. So it's an honor to be part of it, and, you know, maybe for 50 more years.
Well, Bill Sherman and Rosemary Trulio, thank you so much for explaining this all to us. This was great.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Music, maestro!
And you can see the full Tiny Desk concert at NPR.org.
If what I am is what's in me, then I'll stay strong, that's who I'll be.
And I will always be the best me that I can.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil. Metamucil Premium Blend contains plant-based psyllium fiber, is made with natural flavors and colors, and is sweetened with stevia leaf extract. Learn more at Metamucil.com. And Subaru, committed to doing its part to make the world a better place by supporting philanthropic initiatives in local communities. Learn more at Subaru.com/lovepromise. Love. It's what makes a Subaru a Subaru.
This is 90.9 WBUR, online at WBUR.org. Coming up next hour, as All Things Considered continues, Mexico promises to tighten border security amid increasing pressure from the U.S. Mexico now says it is sending its National Guard to the border. In the forecast, mostly cloudy tonight with rain and possible thunderstorms moving in just after the evening commute, temperatures in the 60s. Rain for tomorrow morning, then clouds for the afternoon. Still a lot of humidity, highs in the upper 70s. Sunny skies for Wednesday, highs in the mid-70s. Right now it's 78 degrees in Boston. The time is 5:59.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston.
92.7 WBUA Tisbury.
89.1 WBUH Brewster.
Streaming at WBUR.org.
And live at CitySpace, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
The Justice Department agrees to turn over key evidence from the Robert Mueller Russia investigation to Congress after weeks of tense talks. It's Monday, June 10th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good evening. I'm Jack Lepiarz, in for Lisa Mullins. Coming up, members of the House Judiciary Committee say that evidence could reveal more about possible obstruction of justice by the president. Also, the Red Sox David Ortiz will be flown to Boston tonight for more medical treatment after being shot in the Dominican Republic yesterday.
David Ortiz is probably the most beloved and one of the most important players in our history.
And at 6:30 on Marketplace, digging into the Raytheon United Technologies merger. That news breaking today. It's 6:01. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. On Capitol Hill, the House Judiciary Committee heard testimony today by one of the key figures from the Watergate era. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports former White House counsel John Dean spoke before the panel as it continues to investigate Russian election interference and possible obstruction by President Trump.
Dean, who was a principal witness during the Senate Watergate hearings, told the committee that he sees remarkable parallels between Watergate and the findings of former special counsel Robert Mueller.
In many ways, the Mueller report is to President Trump what the so-called Watergate roadmap was to President Richard Nixon. Stated a little differently, special counsel Mueller has provided this committee with a roadmap.
Notably, Dean called on his Trump-era counterpart, former White House counsel Don McGahn, to testify before the committee. McGahn was seen as a key witness in Mueller's report on whether the president obstructed justice. The White House has ordered McGahn to defy a congressional subpoena. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Iran is once again stockpiling enriched uranium, according to the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, it's the latest sign the nuclear deal with Iran is fraying following the U.S. withdrawal from the agreement.
IAEA Director Yukiya Amano told reporters that the agency had measured an increase in uranium enrichment at Iran's facilities.
Yes, the production rate is increasing.
Amano declined to say by exactly how much or if Iran was in violation of the 2015 nuclear deal. Under that agreement, Iran reduced its stocks of low-enriched uranium and froze its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. But after the U.S. pulled out, that relief never came. Last month, Iran said it would ramp up parts of its nuclear program if the remaining parties to the deal did not provide it with economic benefits. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Washington.
In New York City, a helicopter pilot was killed as he crash-landed on a midtown skyscraper. It happened in dense fog, just minutes after the chopper took off from Manhattan's heliport. Firefighters acted quickly to contain the fuel that leaked from the helicopter. The crash sent shutters through the building and sent people fleeing. Morgan Aries, who works in the building, was among them.
Down the stairwell, there was moments where it was a little chaotic because
you can imagine 30 floors trying to evacuate at the same time.
Right.
So there was moments where you had to actually stop and wait. And that's when the anxiety started to set in for several people. And I started getting a little confused about what exactly had happened.
The NTSB is investigating the cause of the crash. Wall Street was higher by the closing bell. The Dow up 78 points to 26,062. The NASDAQ up 81 points to end at 7823. That's up more than 1%. And the S&P 500 up 13 points at 2886. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. A medical team is expected to airlift Red Sox great David Ortiz from the Dominican Republic to Boston tonight so he can undergo continued medical treatment. Ortiz was shot at a bar last night in his home country. Police are still trying to determine if Ortiz was the intended target. Red Sox manager Alex Cora says the shooting comes as a shock.
It's been a tough one. I just hope, you know, that, you know, when he gets here, everything is fine, and we can see that big man again with us and filling our room with joy.
A spokesman for Ortiz says the 43-year-old had part of his intestines and his gallbladder removed and that his liver was also damaged in the shooting. His condition's described as serious, but stable enough to be brought to Boston. Shares in Waltham-based Raytheon are up nearly 1% today on news that it plans to merge with Connecticut-based United Technologies. The deal would create a massive aerospace and defense company based in the Boston area. And the companies say they expect the combination to create jobs, but leaders with unions at both companies say they are concerned about what the deal means for workers. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh will not hire another education chief at City Hall. WBUR's Max Larkin reports the mayor's eliminating the cabinet-level position, which he created.
When Walsh took office, he created the education chief as a point person overseeing big initiatives like universal pre-kindergarten and a district-wide facilities overhaul. Now, the city's on track to have adequate pre-K seats by 2024, and that overhaul, called Build BPS, is well underway. So Walsh says he'll go without an education chief. Instead, he'll lend his support to incoming Superintendent Brenda Caselius and her team.
I think my job is to provide them with the tools they need to be successful. And I also think it's my job to be the biggest supporter of Boston Public Schools in the city.
Caselius will take over at BPS on July 1st. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Max Larkin.
In sports, the Red Sox will start a four-game set with the Texas Rangers at Fenway. Chris Sale on the mound tonight. Bruins are off until Wednesday for Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final at the Garden. In the forecast, mostly cloudy tonight. Rain and possible thunderstorms moving in after about 7 o'clock or so. Temperatures in the 60s. Right now, 77 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Audie Cornish. We start this hour at an immigration checkpoint in southern Mexico. Late last week, the U.S. and Mexico struck a deal on immigration, a deal that stopped President Trump from carrying out a threat to impose tariffs.
As part of that deal, Mexico pledged to deploy its brand new National Guard to fight illegal immigration. Mexico also said it would keep more Central American migrants on its side of the border while the U.S. processes their asylum claims. In a few moments, we'll hear about the strain this puts on Mexican cities.
First, we're joined by reporter James Frederick at that checkpoint in southern Mexico. And James, I understand you're about 30 minutes from the border with Guatemala. Can you talk about what you've been seeing there?
Yeah, so I'm under a bridge on a highway that goes north from the Guatemala-Mexico border. And there's about 10 immigration agents here, as well as federal police and soldiers. And this is really what they're doing for migration enforcement right now. This is looking to change with the agreement that was made between U.S. and Mexico recently. Mexican officials say that 6,000 National Guards members will be coming down here. And the National Guard is really the main new security force by President Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
Tell us more about the Mexican National Guard, because it was just announced a few weeks ago. What's going on there?
So the National Guard is really the primary security policy of President López Obrador, who was in his first year here. And basically, he pitched the National Guard as a modern, sophisticated, kind of hybrid military-civilian force. This force would basically have police powers to arrest people. And then specifically talking about migration, it would be the only security force in Mexico that would have the authority on its own to arrest undocumented migrants. This is really all theoretical right now because President López Obrador has talked a lot about it, but there is no active National Guard right now. And we're kind of waiting to see exactly when National Guard gets rolled out.
My next question was going to be whether these Guard members have been trained, but you're saying this force doesn't exist yet. So where are they going to come from?
Well, so what we know so far is about 1,500 National Guards members are currently being trained. They're not fully trained yet. And this training question is really important because, as President López Obrador has pushed it, this is a modern force. It's going to be very respectful of human rights. He said Mexican police and army have had several scandals around human rights. And the feeling that they are trying to rush this out for migration enforcement really doesn't engender a lot of confidence that this is going to be the modern security force that can make Mexico safer.
You've underscored that troublesome history. Can you talk about how people are reacting to this? Is it controversial in Mexico?
Yeah, it's really just a sense of not knowing what the National Guard is right now. I spoke earlier today to the mayor of the town of Ciudad Hidalgo. It's the little town that's right on the Mexico-Guatemala border. She said she has no news about when National Guard might be on the border, but she did say the federal government got in touch with her to ask her to find a plot of land where they could build a National Guard base. So, I mean, that also gives you an idea of what stage the National Guard is really at in being rolled out.
In the end, is this establishment of the National Guard and this cooperation with the U.S. going to be a major kind of policy issue for López Obrador? Like, is this going to be part of his political legacy?
It sure seems like it, because, you know, the National Guard is what he said was going to be the thing that solves violence in Mexico. And what I'm really curious to see is if they indeed roll out these first, you know, 6,000 National Guard members here to the border, how are Mexicans going to react? This is a force they thought was going to be used to fight organized crime here in Mexico. If it's just for migration enforcement, I don't expect that Mexicans are going to feel very happy about that.
That's reporter James Frederick in southern Mexico. Thank you for your reporting.
Thanks, Adi.
Let's head now to Mexico's northern border and look at another aspect of this U.S.-Mexico deal. The city of Tijuana is like a lot of Mexican cities in that it is struggling to house and care for Central American migrants forced to stay in Mexico as their asylum claims in the U.S. are being processed. That program that keeps migrants in Mexico is now set to expand as part of this new agreement. NPR's Carrie Kahn was just in Tijuana. She joined us now from the other side of the border in San Diego. Hey, Carrie.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi. So the so-called Remain in Mexico program, which we've been talking about for a while, I said it's going to change. How so?
The U.S. government wants to send more U.S. asylum seekers back to Mexico to wait out their court procedures. And it began in December, but the U.S. government wants to send a lot more people back. And so that's the expansion that we're talking about.
So we're talking same program, more numbers.
Mexico's foreign minister was directly asked, how can you take in more numbers? What are we talking about? 20, 30,000? He sort of avoided the question and said, our southern border enforcement and our buildup of troops along the southern border with Guatemala is really going to help stem the numbers that are coming to the border. So this might be a moot point in general. We might not have to take back as many people. But that's a big grasp, and we'll have to see how quickly they can bring the troops down to the border and whether they can make a difference.
I mentioned you've just been in Tijuana, Carrie. I mean, what is the impact there of this policy?
There have always been migrants in Tijuana. This has always been a throughway and a big crossing point for migrants. So this is nothing new for the city. The number of people that are staying now and not just going through, that is new. But if you look at the Remain in Mexico program, since December, Mexico has sent back to about almost 11,000 U.S. asylum-seeking migrants. Not all of those have gone to Tijuana, and Tijuana is a city of about 1.5 million people, so it's not that huge of an impact. The problem is that they all stay congregated congregated along the border region, which is not a very safe part of town. And there are no resources from the federal government there to help them out. So nonprofits and church groups and religious organizations are the ones that are picking up the slack. And it's been a difficult situation for those groups and that area around the border.
I wonder, is this sparking tension between cities and their leaders, mayors and so forth, and the federal government in Mexico City?
Definitely. They've been asking for more resources since we've seen these large migrant caravans come up to the border, and they've been demanding more resources. And it has created tensions between the states and the federal government.
What about for the migrants themselves? What have you been able to observe through your reporting in terms of the impact on them of staying longer in Mexico under this program?
It's a difficult situation because they don't have relatives here. They don't have a support system here. The government has not been able to provide jobs and stable areas to stay in. And what's happening is that this is not where they want to stay. They want to go to the United States. They don't feel safe in Tijuana. They don't feel safe in border cities along Mexico. And their ultimate goal is to make it to the U.S.
NPR's Carrie Kahn. Thanks, Carrie.
You're welcome.
Bushwick Bill of the Houston rap group Ghetto Boys has died at age 52.
This year, Halloween fell on a weekend. Me and Ghetto Boys are trick-or-treating, robbing little kids for bags.
Bushwick Bill was born Richard Shaw in Kingston, Jamaica. His family moved to the Bushwick section of Brooklyn when he was a kid, but Houston, Texas is where he became a ghetto boy, joining Willie D and Scarface to become pioneers of gangster rap. He told his fans that he had pancreatic cancer just last month. Now, to talk about Bushwick Bill and his legacy is NPR's Rodney Carmichael. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Audie.
Tell us about Bushwick Bill as a rapper.
Well, Bushwick Bill, he was a vivid storyteller and really one of the most charismatic figures in hip-hop. He ended up getting into rap almost by accident. And really, now he deserves probably more credit than just about anybody for popularizing Southern rap. And especially horrorcore.
Horrorcore. Okay, tell me a little bit about that, because that came around, what, the late 80s?
Yeah, so horrorcore was basically like this offshoot of gangster rap. You know, these really graphic descriptions of murder and mutilation, often of women. But Bushwick was also a guy who'd actually been studying to become a missionary and a minister before all of this. Then there's the fact that he was a little person with a disability that really made him an outcast and made his own life pretty horrific in some ways.
You can hear that in some of his classic verses, right, from the Ghetto Boys song, Mind Playing Tricks on Me.
But this wasn't no ordinary man. He stood about 6 or 7 feet. Now that's the creep I be seeing in my sleep.
Rodney, you know, people look back at this song now and they talk about it as one that tells the story of someone suffering from trauma, right? Someone who lives a violent life. Can you talk about how this played out in his music?
Well, you know, violence and trauma was a world that Bushwick was not, you know, afraid to deal with. And it wasn't always fictional. You know, one of the heaviest songs on his debut album, Little Big Man, it basically lays out a real life event where Bushwick lost his eye to a gunshot during an argument with his girlfriend. And he even ends up being declared dead before coming back to life when this happens. And he was drunk on Everclear at the time, he says in the song, and that inspired the song's title, which was Ever So Clear, which really ends up being this clear-eyed, really confessional song of enlightenment for Bushwick.
See, most of my life I never had this. I felt like an outcast, treated like a misfit. Damn near didn't make it on my day of birth. Thinking, was I really supposed to be on this planet Earth? I take a deep breath and then another follows. Because hardship is kind of hard to swallow. See, it's rough.
I know it's a long way from his early days of studying religion, but toward the end of his life and career, what kind of music was he doing?
Well, you know, Bushwick made the classic 360-degree circle in his life and time. And he really ended up returning back to his roots and to Christianity. He got born again, and he was really making music that was a lot closer to gospel in his later years. Very uplifting music.
This is real talk. I'm on a righteous walk. Left the dark, now I'm shining my light like Louis the Lightning Bug. You can call me a thug, a true homie unto God. Till the rapture comes, I'm back to song.
But it wasn't the type of thing where he totally disowned what he had done in the past. He had unique ways of being able to mesh together all of the routes his life had taken into one big story that he felt like was a made him a witness and an inspiration for a lot of people.
That's NPR's Rodney Carmichael talking to us about the legacy of Bushwick Bill of the Ghetto Boys. Bill died at the age of 52.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, the latest on David Ortiz after the former Red Sox slugger was shot in the back in the Dominican Republic last night. In business news, an Arizona-based drug company is declaring bankruptcy 1 month after its founder was convicted of racketeering in Boston federal court. The move by Insys Therapeutics also comes days after one of its operating units agreed to a $225 million settlement with federal regulators. That settlement over allegations of bribing doctors to prescribe a fentanyl spray to patients. Coming up at WBUR City Space tomorrow, June 11th, senior environmental editor Barbara Moran interviews marine ecologist Layla Hatch after a screening of the documentary Sonic Sea. In the forecast, showers and storms tonight. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
We'll see showers overspread the area during the evening hours. By 9 or 10 o'clock, all of us should be seeing them. Temperatures stay in the 60s all night long. You'll feel the humidity. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms the first part of the day, then just cloudy, muggy, warm. Temperatures in the 70s to near 80. It clears out Tuesday night, and that will set the stage for a gorgeous Wednesday, sunshine mid-70s. Thursday, another system brings showers, temperatures in the upper 60s to near 70. Friday, mostly sunny, low 70s. And right now, the start of the weekend looks nice and dry.
Right now, 76 degrees in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Kimball Fruit Farm in Pepperell, a fourth-generation farm practicing eco-friendly integrated pest management with farmers markets throughout greater Boston. KimballFruitFarm.com.
This is WBUR's All Things Considered. I'm Jack Lepiarz in for Lisa Mullins. The Boston Red Sox are bringing David Ortiz to Boston for medical care after the retired slugger was shot in the Dominican Republic last night. Speaking with the media a short time ago, Red Sox President Sam Kennedy called Ortiz one of the most beloved and important players in Red Sox history.
It's hard to express what David Ortiz means to the Boston Red Sox. When you love someone and they come in harm's way, it's jarring.
Ortiz's injuries are more serious than originally reported, but he is expected to recover. WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer joins us now in the studio with the latest. Shira, welcome.
Thanks.
So what's the latest here from Red Sox officials and their plan to bring David Ortiz back to Boston?
Well, they didn't reveal any new specifics about Ortiz's condition, but Red Sox doctors have been in contact with doctors in the Dominican Republic, and there's some good news that came out of what Sam Kennedy said about the plan from this point forward.
Our medical team here in Boston and the doctors in the Dominican Republic have confirmed that David's condition is still serious, but that he is stable enough to be transported back here to Boston for continued care. In coordination with our medical team, the club has arranged for a medical air ambulance to transport David to Boston from Santo Domingo. Our hope is that David will arrive here in Boston sometime later tonight.
And when he does arrive back in Boston, he will be treated at Mass General.
What do we know about his injuries and the surgery that he's undergone?
Well, he was shot in the lower back at close range. The bullet exited the abdomen. Initially, Ortiz's father said that the bullet didn't damage any major organs. That was sort of in the initial frenzy after the shooting. But a spokesman for Ortiz says that doctors removed his gallbladder and part of his intestines, and that he also suffered liver damage. Again, the Red Sox wouldn't release any more information about his medical condition. Sam Kennedy expressed thanks to the surgeons in the Dominican Republic who operated on Ortiz.
Now, we know there is one man in custody in connection with this shooting. What have you learned about him and any potential motive?
Well, he's 25 years old. We don't know his actual alleged role in the shooting or possible motive. Don't even know if Ortiz was the intended target. There may have been more than one perpetrator as well. And Red Sox execs didn't go into anything about the shooting and said their sole focus has been on Ortiz's health and the logistics of getting him to Boston for continued medical care. So still awaiting more details on the actual investigation of the shooting.
That's WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, thanks.
Thank you.
And Dominicans in the Boston area are reacting with sadness to the shooting. WBUR Simone Rios brings us to a barbershop in Boston's South End where David Ortiz has often gotten his hair cut.
Walk into MLB Barbershop on Tremont Street and you can't avoid the presence of Big Papi even if you try. There's a massive cutout of Papi on the wall, a Big Papi street sign, and a mock-up of the iconic Beatles Abbey Road cover, with Papi in the place of John Lennon. One of the barbers at MLB is Gino Almonte, who lives just down the street in Roxbury. I'm worried, Almonte says. A guy like David, he's someone everyone likes. He treats people well. Now everybody's talking about what happened, watching the news, checking our phones for updates on his health. The owner of MLB Barbershop is Jose de la Rosa, known in the community as Bacano. He's been cutting Papi's hair since 2004, when the Red Sox won the World Series for the first time in 86 years. De la Rosa says he feels down today. He describes Ortiz as a friend, a brother. He says Ortiz gave him the keys to his house, and he can come and go as he pleases. De La Rosa has worked as a clubhouse barber at Fenway Park for 10 years and says he continues to cut Ortiz's hair when he's in Boston. With news of the shooting, he called Ortiz's father and was relieved to hear his friend was expected to recover. Ortiz was shot outside a nightclub. For De La Rosa, it's another reminder of the daily reality of life in his native Dominican Republic. Insecurity has gotten out of control, De La Rosa says. I think the lack of education is the biggest problem, and the politicians, the people in charge, they don't fix the problem. For the youth, there's no work, no future. So they take to the streets to see if they can improve their situation. De La Rosa says he has a message to send Ortiz about hanging out around nightclubs. I hope he gets well soon and takes it a little bit easier, De La Rosa says. He doesn't need to go to places like that anymore. He should be with his family. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Simon Rios.
State leaders are pleased that another big company is being lured away from Connecticut to set up shop here in Massachusetts. Raytheon Technologies will be formed from the merger of Waltham-based Raytheon and Connecticut-based United Technologies, and the new defense giant will be headquartered in Massachusetts. WBUR's Steve Brown looks at what's making the Bay State an attractive place for businesses to call home.
Governor Baker says his office did not take part in discussions between Raytheon and United Technologies, and so did not attempt to lure the headquarters to Massachusetts. He did have a conversation with Raytheon executives over the weekend.
One of the things that made this whole thing work was the reputation of the people in Massachusetts, their work ethic, their creativity, their imagination, and frankly, the tremendous pool of really talented STEM students and people who currently work in those fields.
It's the most recent blow for Connecticut and a win for Massachusetts in recent years. In 2016, General Electric pulled up stakes from its longtime home in the Nutmeg State and moved its headquarters to Boston. More recently, MassMutual shut down an office in Enfield, Connecticut, while expanding in Massachusetts. During a conference call with investors, United Technologies CEO Greg Hayes downplayed the significance of the headquarters move.
Raytheon Technologies, as will be called, will be headquartered in the greater Boston metro area. Now, we want to emphasize, particularly for the benefit of United Technologies employees, this does not mean that we're exiting operations in Connecticut and moving to Boston. In fact, Raytheon Technologies will maintain a strong presence in Connecticut for years to come.
But Mark Gallagher of the Massachusetts High Technology Council says companies are increasingly sensitive to some of the tax pressure that they're feeling in states like Connecticut.
And I think conversely, Massachusetts has worked really hard over the last couple of decades to shed the Taxachusetts moniker that did not help us attract business a couple of decades ago. And based on some good policymaking decisions, we've ended up in a place where the tax burden here is, we land pretty squarely in the middle.
Gallagher says Connecticut's tax policies have shifted over the past few decades and believes they have become more burdensome for businesses. But he adds favorable tax policy isn't the only reason why companies relocate here. Quality of life, along with a strong talent pool, are also attractive to businesses. He says Massachusetts has to seize on those advantages to keep the momentum going.
Avoid self-inflicted wounds. And really, part of our biggest challenge is avoiding complacency and really managing the growth we have so that we leverage it and don't choke on it.
The vast majority of United Technologies jobs in Connecticut will remain in Connecticut. Officials say only about 100 top executive jobs will move to the Boston area. The deal still must be approved by shareholders and the federal government. It's expected the new company will have a value of over $100 billion. The deal is expected to be finalized during the first half of 2020. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Steve Brown.
Coming up on WBUR, it's Marketplace. Tonight, the architecture of America's ballparks and what it says about the cities that built them. That's up next. In the forecast, mostly cloudy tonight with rain and possible thunderstorms moving in just after the evening commute. Temperatures in the 60s. Rain for tomorrow morning, clouds for the afternoon, highs in the upper 70s.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Adelaide of Newton Center, a benchmark mind and memory community coming soon, bridging the art of relationships with technology and programs for dementia. AdelaideNewton.com. The ICA Watershed in East Boston, now open in its second season. Ride across the harbor to see work by acclaimed artist John Acomfra, ICABoston.org. And the Seacrest Beach Hotel Falmouth, beachfront rooms on a private stretch of Old Silver Beach, ocean view dining, white sand, sunsets. SeacrestBeachHotel.com.